WRIF. WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now, take a ride.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and joined by Jillian Jordan. Hi, Jillian.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
It's another Sunday in Detroit as we broadcast all across the Detroit metro area.
Yes.
The Great Lakes Basin, including Canada, and across the United States and the world via our stream at WRIF.com. Speaking of WRIF, we're all excited here because tomorrow morning, Drew Lane rejoins his pal Mike Clark with the Drew and Mike Show.
Yeah, this is exciting stuff for the radio station and
absolutely.
The city.
Yeah, so here's what you should do. Is you should stay up late and listen to this program.
Yes.
And get up early.
And take a nap.
that's right. Usually we've been starting every show talking about Sarah Palin. But
which we easily could again.
Yeah, but we'll put that off a little. All I have to say is thank you, Satan.
Oh, and what are you talking about?
I said, yes, we can.
What?
What did you think I said?
You said, thank you, Satan.
I did not. I said, yes, we can. Here's what we're talking about. This has actually been around a little while, so many of you may have seen this. But, in fact, if you go on the Internet, what was that last president's name before Barack Obama?
W.
He used to say, go to the Google. Well, if you go to the Google and put in, thank you, Satan, you get this over-the-top video. Now, hopefully, this is a comic, or was meant with comedic intent. But, you know, these right-wingers are such whack jobs that they, in fact, could believe that if you take Barack Obama's words and play them backwards, that they actually have meaning. So, here, I'll play you just a little bit of it. It starts off with Barack Obama saying his famous little mantra of, yes, we can. Let's see.
Yes, we can.
Yes, we can.
Yes, we can.
Okay.
All right.
Yes, we can.
Actually, they have him saying it quite a few times.
Yes, we can.
Okay. Okay. Now, this is what you're listening to.
Say.
Wait.
As you say.
As
you say.
Are you calling it Paul is dead?
As you say.
Thank you, Satan.
As you say.
And who took the time to do this?
It's not that hard. Well, here, wait a minute. Here. Then they take whole portions of his speech. Yes, we can.
And I wish everyone could see your face right now, because you are getting such pleasure out of this.
I don't know why.
I don't either.
Wish. Thank you, Satan. Thank you, Satan. Thank you.
Peter.
Because they're playing that backward. This is the backward tapes. So the crowd enthusiastically...
American creed. Yes, we can. Thank you, Satan.
Here from the grandma.
Thank you, Satan. Here from the grandma. Thank you, Satan. Here from
I don't know.
Grandma. Yes, we can.
All right.
I think you needed comedic relief so bad.
The law of sudden death sits in the window. Thank you, Satan.
The Lord said the new Arab sins are with him.
Oh, someone is stretching on this. Hey, Peter.
What?
It's a live radio show.
Are we on the air? Oh, okay. All right. All right.
Yes, we can. Thank you, Satan.
We are.
Subvert the mark that's now sooner. Thank you, Satan.
Well,
I mean, I'm actually fearful that, in fact, whoever put this together really believes that you can discern real meaning by taking people's words and then playing them backwards. But I never understood that. You know, this is at least 30 years old, back to the Led Zeppelin days.
That one, you know.
When they used to call it backward masking, and these Christian preachers said that if you played Led Zeppelin backwards, you'd get all this praise. And there were some famous phrases. phrases. But someone tipped me off, and then I used to do this, and I was going, I mean, everybody's been so busy around here, what with Drew and Mike coming back and all that, that I just
and
didn't
summer.
Want to. Yeah, yeah. But if you say Jesus loves you, if you play it backwards, and you used to like just turn the tape over. Now you can just do it digitally, and that's so it's pretty easy to do. Except I don't know how to do it. In any event, it says, "I smell sausage." And if you, say, you know, "I smell sausage," it goes back. Jesus loves you.
Like that. This sounds just seems like such a waste of time to me. I don't know.
Okay. All right. I just trying to have a little fun here. We got a lot of serious things to talk about.
Peter.
There's a war going on, the economy, health care, all of that. But, it's, you know, we lighten it up a little. But I can see you don't want to go there. All right. Nobody's calling
I've gone
either.
There. Yeah. I'm over it.
You're listening to Night Call on WRIF with me, Peter Werby, and Jalene Jordan. Our phone numbers are 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And for the bashful, and when the phones are filled, which they are not right now, it is calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Please, the reason I hesitate is because what I'm going to next is only a little less silly, maybe even more. But it's more about Barack Obama. Did you see this stuff that they have this photograph of him checking out the butt of this woman?
I don't believe that he was doing that. I think that that's how the camera angle made it appear. Not that he's above looking at a woman's, you know, rear end.
Yeah. Well, I think it was interesting, again, that it that it appeared all over the right-wing internet sites and
of course, see?
And
exactly.
And ABC News ran this film of it. It says, on first glance, the snapshot appears to show President Obama caught in a moment of less than lofty analysis. But upon looking at the video, the moment might seem to appear quite innocent. One of those times when a picture can be misleading. The president was on a higher step and was stepping down, so he looked down to assure his footing as the woman was walking up the stairs.
I knew it.
I think he was looking at her butt.
No.
You know what? I got to tell
you. Michelle is hot. His wife is hot.
I know he's hot. You know, my wife is hot.
She is.
But you know what I would do? I would pretend I was looking at the stair below me.
quick peripheral.
Yeah. Guys do that. It's in you know, it's in the genetic makeup
of
men.
It for sure is. Yeah.
I mean, it's got to be. I mean, you know, that's what keeps the species going, right?
I guess so.
Yeah. I mean, you know, everybody doesn't have to do it or anything like that, but we got enough people. But there's still the genetic drive.
Yes.
Yes. Yes, we can.
Yes, we can.
Oh, 50 right for it. What if somebody just tuned in right now? I have no
idea. These people are tripping.
Yeah, they are. Oh, you mean us? Yeah. Well, Barack Obama, this is interesting. Barack Obama, I thought there was a lot of interesting things about it. He was in Accra, Ghana, the capital of Ghana. And this article in the Associated Press says, "America's president and Africa's son, Barack Obama, dashed with pride onto the continent of his ancestors Saturday, challenging its people to shed corruption and conflict in favor of peace." You know, there's an expression that says, physician, heal thyself. I mean, he is lecturing. I mean, I got to tell you, Ghana is more corrupt and less peaceful than the United States, to be sure. But it's not. I mean, this is a very, very corrupt country, as we can see. I mean, just the tip of the iceberg, all the people that have gone down. I'm not talking about, you know, nitwits like, Mark Sanford, the governor of South Carolina. I'm talking about the widespread financial corruption that actually loots the wealth of this country and makes more and leaves by the elites and leaves a lot less for the average person. But I also thought, where is this? Obama told a riveted Ghanaian parliament, I say this knowing full well, oh, he said, yes, you can. I say this knowing full well. See, he said it again. Yes, you can. Thank you, Satan. That's the contention if you're just joining us, that if you put yes, you can back. It was yes, we can.
Yes, right? We can.
Yeah.
Backwards.
Anyways, I say this knowing full well the tragic past that has sometimes haunted this part of the world. I have the blood of Africa within me, which is true. But you know, isn't there sort of what we call a missing referent here? I mean, because actually, and I don't want to take anything away from the pride that that African-American people in this country feel towards Barack Obama. I mean, I'm proud that actually a country was able to overcome, you know, such deep-seated racism and mm-hmm. elect somebody like Barack Obama. But he's mixed race. You know, it's really a reflection of the diversity of the United States, and he has the blood of Europe coursing through his veins as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a racist country when if you have a single drop of black blood, whatever the hell that is, right. You're considered to be black.
Blood is blood, people.
Blood is blood, yeah. In the faces of those who lined the streets, and in many of Obama's own words, this trip was personal. Beyond his message, the story was his presence, the first black U.S. president coming to poor, proud, predominantly black sub-Saharan Africa for the first time in office. But, you know, maybe I'm just stretching the point too much, because I think self-conception, even though, he knows his mother was white, and he knows that whole side, yeah. His maternal side, and usually that is how ethnicity and religion and stuff like that is traced.
Right.
It's maternal. It's what they call matrilineal, you know, the line of the mother. And, I mean, the most uncomfortable thing is the little aphorism, which is mama baby, papa maybe, right? I mean, you know.
Right, true.
Right, yeah. I mean, that's, yeah.
Mama knows.
Mama knows.
What happened.
Yeah, yeah. So, that's, you know, unfortunately, we had great expectations for Barack Obama. He has not discovered a cure for cancer, nor cured numerous other things.
Right.
So a lot of people are beginning to peel off in terms of their support of him. But some of it is reasonable disillusionment. And I don't know if you saw that, how these Greenpeace climbers got on top of the Mount Rushmore monument and said, come on, man, you just caved to all the special interests on climate change, on the so-called energy bill.
And they were arrested.
Yeah, they were arrested for trespassing. But Friends of the Earth, Greenpeace, Public Citizen opposed the bill that Barack Obama signed. Now, I just want to say, and a couple of people have said, man, why are you apologizing for Barack Obama? I want to tell you that I never had any illusions about him in the first place. I mean, I knew that, that this was a referendum on the last 8 years of two stolen presidential elections, of a trashing of the Constitution, lies about wars, the destruction of the economy and the middle class, and the here I'm taking about 20 minutes to do the missteps and the crimes of the Bush regime, the illegal Bush regime, and we'll even talk a little more about some of the crimes in a bit. But Barack Obama, as just an individual coming out of a traditional political party that switches the presidency, which switches from Democrats to Republicans, mm-hmm. Democrats to Republicants, you know, all that, couldn't help. I mean, if he was going to be worse, I don't know what he would do. He'd be like a fascist dictatorship, right. Or something like that. So he had to be better, and he has been extraordinarily better. But, these things he inherited, he's maintained the same policies, like Iraq and Afghanistan and the bailout of the economy. All that began with the Bush administration. The bailout did. Remember, it wasn't just the fact that Bushco, the corrupt, talk about corruption, the corrupt Bushco, caused this, but also that was their scheme was to bail out the banks and the large financial institutions. And as I've said, week after week after week, if you were dependent on one man occupying the presidency to change everything, forget it. I mean, he's not going to. The reason that he didn't sign a stronger climate bill, energy bill, is because there wasn't all of us demanding it. We were hoping. We had the audacity of hope that Barack Obama would do everything for us and do things maybe 180 degrees opposite of what's been done. He would, in fact, almost become a revolutionary.
I expected more of him on this issue. I mean, I knew that he would be wimpy on war and, you know, continue and escalate things in Afghanistan. But on this issue, I thought he'd be a little better.
I think it's, you know, within the context, and I'm not apologizing. I mean, you know, there's a difference between an explanation and an excuse. This is an explanation. I mean, this is a, this is the matrix. This is what he's operating in, inside of. And to go outside of it by himself, it's not going to work, you know, for him or the Democrats. So it's up to us to make history. If we don't make history, things are going to go on a little bit better. But we need more than a little bit better. Well, things are looking up for Goldman Sachs. I don't know if you...
Oh, I saw this. So they were bailed out. Let me get this right. And now everything's hunky-dory,
right? They're making a ton.
Yeah.
Most of Wall Street in America, says the New York Times, is still waiting for an economic recovery. Then there's Goldman Sachs. This is a big financial firm. Up and down Wall Street, analysts and traders are buzzing that Goldman, which only recently paid back its government bailout money, so some of it's coming back in, will report blowout profits from trading on Tuesday. Analysts predict the bank earned more than $2 billion in March-June period thanks to its trading prowess across world markets. Now, you're thinking, wait a minute, nobody's loaning money, even if you can't get a mortgage hardly,
right,
and all that. If they're right, the bank's rivals will once again be left to wonder exactly how Goldman could have rebounded so dramatically only months after the nation's financial industry was shaken to its foundations. Well, one of the things you might do is go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. There's a Rolling Stone article. Has a new Rolling Stone come out yet? I don't know. So it's either in this month's or last. The Great American Bubble Machine, Matt Tibbe, on how Goldman Sachs has engineered every major market manipulation since the Great Depression. So I haven't read it yet. I mean, I read part of it, enough to know that I want this on there. But I didn't get down. I mean, this is a very long article. Let's see. The obsessive speculation about how they did this has already begun, along with banter about how Goldman's rapid return to minting money will be perceived by lawmakers and taxpayers who aided Goldman with a multi-billion-dollar cushion last fall. Well, I mean, if they paid back the money they took from us...
Yeah.
But startling, too, is how much of its profits Goldman is expected to share with its employees. Think about how much you're making or your parents are making or something like that. Analysts estimate that the bank will set aside enough money to pay a total of $18 billion in compensation and benefits this year to its 28,000 employees, or more than $600,000 per employee, with top producers standing to earn millions.
Wow.
Yeah, it's good in America. Oh, well, if you're work for Goldman Sachs, right?
Depends on who you are.
GM's coming back. Good news for the Motor... Are we still the Motor City?
Motown, maybe.
Yeah,
Motown. We're back to that.
They emerged from bankruptcy on Friday, and Fritz Henderson is going to ask more than 400 of the 1,300 executives in the United States to resign or retire. He says, we got too many of them. The cuts pale in comparison to the tens of thousands of factory workers and salaried employees who have been eliminated during GM's long decline. Why do I think, and probably many of you do as well, or give us a shot what you think of this whole GM deal, 313-298-WRIF, we'll get you on the air, that this is going to wind up with them paying tons less workers just cutting the workforce, period. They're going to pay the workers that remain much less, in many cases half that, and the CEOs are going to make somewhere near the same.
So whereas the headlines sound hunky-dory underneath all of that, it's pretty sad.
Yeah, what about the rest of us? Now here, I'll read these in this order. Doubts about Obama's economic recovery plan rise along with unemployment. And Obama said that things would get tougher before they got better. Unemployment already at 9.5%. Let's call it 10%. And there's so much hidden unemployment. There's so much underemployment. People having to work at jobs, finding jobs, but working at much less than they had previously. Now, I don't understand this. They're talking about that 5 months after Congress agreed on the plan to put out almost $1 trillion, or three quarters of a trillion, only a fraction of the money has actually been out the door. I mean, so I don't think it's arriving. That's the point. It's not arriving at the States, for instance, that could do a lot of construction and stuff like that. And so Obama's popularity has dropped sharply, including in Ohio, where they say that 48% of respondents said they have disapproved of Obama's handling the economy, while less, 46% approved, down 11 percentage points. So people, you know, saying, what's that? Whole thing. Where's the beef?
And 76% of Republicans would vote for Sarah Palin.
You do want to talk about Sarah Palin.
Not really. I'm just a little contrast there.
Yeah. Administration officials say a job market recovery usually lags behind the economic recovery itself. Indeed, most forecasters had predicted that unemployment was likely to keep rising through the end of 2009 and would not start to turn around till 2010. A lot of poor-paying jobs because, the union's just crumpling in front of the pressure. Here, though, you can always depend on the Republicans to say something positive. Michigan's unemployment rate could hit as high as 20%.
What?
With the Obama administration to blame, according to Thaddeus McCotter from out around Plymouth and Northville, around there. Yeah, we already have the highest in the country, 14.1, and you go into Detroit, it's already depression levels, 25-30% of the, almost a third of the employable workforce isn't working in Detroit. And this is, according to McCotter, because of Obama policies. Sadly, we've seen estimates because of the radical restructuring that the auto task force demanded that this year Michigan could wind up over 20% unemployment. So the fact that, I don't get this, the McCotter, who's not the sharpest knife in the drawer to begin with, said that it sounds like what's being said here, that if they hadn't have bailed out the auto companies, what? I can't even finish the sentence.
Yeah, I really don't get it either.
No, I mean, that's it. I mean, the idea of this these bailouts really hits me as pretty shaky. But I've never gotten from critics, other than they should say that let it all just collapse, which the fear on the part of the Obama administration was that it's very possible that the collapse of the entire, well, it would, if the entire United States financial and manufacturing sectors collapse, it would drag the entire economy of the world down completely, as opposed to some of what it's done. Michigan hasn't exceeded its previous record for unemployment in modern history when it reached 16.9% in November of 1982. Now, who was president in 1982?
Ooh,
let's scratch our... The great communicator himself.
Reagan.
That's right. Ronald Reagan. I wonder... I don't know how old McCotter was. Let me see. That was 27 years ago. But I wonder if his ilk would have blamed Reagan for that, or would they have said this was all the result of Carter?
Oh, of course.
Of course, they'd already been in for a while with the Reagan. There's an interesting a number of comments by George Lakey, who has written several books and founded the group Training for Change. He directs a research project at Swarthmore College, which I believe is in Pennsylvania. But he's writing a book on Norway, and he wrote a piece calling Seeing Obama as Norwegians See Him. He said he just returned from Norway, and that he talked to a number of people. He said the first was Kristin Clement, the director of a conservative think tank, who said, "This spring on a delegation to Washington, I was struck again," she said, "by how different the political spectrum is in Norway from your country. Here, Obama would be on the right wing." So these nut job conservatives here in the United States are saying, Obama's a socialist.
Truly are nutty, you mean.
But if you put him in Europe, at best, I don't think he'd be on the right, but he'd be a center-rightist.
Hey, a friend of mine has a new way of, on Facebook, you can put your political affiliation, and she has ice cream socialist. You like it?
I like that. You do get that, folks? Like they have the old-fashioned ice cream social?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I don't know if I had to say that. let's see, a half a century ago, Norway already had a universal health care system that is simplicity itself, this author writes. There's a single payer, the government, and minimum red tape, something like Medicare, but for everyone and better. The entire political spectrum supports this. By contrast, Obama says he backs the failed U.S. private insurance scheme, and his team is wobbling on his own modest proposal to add a public option. By July 24th, probably one of the worst minimum wages in, I think, in the Western world, will go from, I think, like $6.75 an hour to $7.25 an hour. So if you're working for $7.25 an hour, you're making about $14,000 or $15,000 mm-hmm. a year. That's, I thought I saw this here, that someone that said, I didn't underline the quote, but, if you're working, that it ought to take you out of poverty, not keep you in it. I got so many other things here, but just so everybody thinks I'm always bashing religion and bashing the Catholic Church and the Muslim religion, and I haven't bashed Hinduism or Judaism or stuff.
No,
like that.
Buddhism.
I wouldn't do that.
That would be like very un-Buddha-like.
Yeah. But the Pope, never mind. I was going to say something nasty. Never mind. But he's...
You were going to bash the Pope?
No, I wasn't.
Right after saying that?
I guess I didn't. You'll have to catch up with the rebroadcast of this. No, why would he even say that? But he's published an encyclical called Charity and Truth that the message is that global capitalism has raced off the moral rails, and that Roman Catholic teachings can help set Western economics right by encouraging them to focus more on justice for the weak and closely regulating the market. So this guy that started off in the Hitler Youth is sounding like a commie.
Oh, that's right.
Sounding like a commie, right? Well, good for him. I mean, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. We really should do a break, but I've been yakking and yakking. I'm Peter Werby. Jalene Jordan is with me, and our numbers are 313-298-WRIF. And why don't we take a call? In the meantime, you can call while we take our break, right after we talk to Paul from Sterling Heights. Paul, you're our first caller. Welcome to the broadcast.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
I'm Union 2. I'm one of the dinosaurs, Union Auto Worker.
Yeah.
I'm trying to bring this up with more and more of my fellow workers. And, in fact, the first time in my career, this is like 34 years, I'm going to run for union office.
There is
one issue, a prime issue, that the rank and file, the UAW, have to be made aware of and ask themselves some questions. The rank and file now deserves the right to vote for the leaders at Solidarity House, because with the last contract, Solidarity House now administers our pensions and our health.
That's right. Let me just remind people that Solidarity House is the building of which actually Jalene and I broadcast out of when we worked for the UAW.
Drove by it today.
Yeah, and it is the headquarters of the United Auto Workers. And
some
a place,
big things have happened there.
Big things have happened. Like what? You and me? What?
Yeah.
Okay.
In the past.
All right.
It has a long history.
It does. Go ahead, though. I'm sorry, Paul. Go ahead.
You guys realize what I'm talking about. With that amount of money can come a lot of corruption. And if you know the history of the union, the communists were kept out of power by only allowing the chairman and the president of each local to vote for the leaders of Solidarity House. Now that the pension and the health care is being administered directly by the union.
Well, they've overseen a billion-dollar investment fund for a long time, and the UAW has, to its credit, has one of the lowest, compensates its officers at one of the lowest rates of any of the big unions, and for some right reason, the Secretary Treasurer's name is right out of my brain, who I know is a pretty decent lady person.
I'm just saying, with that amount of money,
it's possible that corruption could set in.
Yeah, and okay. it just might be time for the rank and file to take a look at. They're actually being a direct democratically elected union seats.
Well, Paul, you seem to know a lot about the history of the UAW, so you know there's been any number of caucuses within the UAW over the years that has demanded direct election of officers. And right, Walter Reuther and the rest of them made sure that after the many members of the Communist Party who were early organizers of the United Auto Workers were thrown out, and that the rank and file did not have direct access to voting for officers. All right, Paul, thank you very much. I actually have to take a break right now. We're getting some other calls. Our phone number is here for us at Night Call. Me, Peter Werby, and Jalene Jordan is 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743. There's a couple open lines, so feel free to call.
And you know that by memory, huh?
I do.
How come I can't remember?
Sharp as a tack over here.
All right, we'll be back.
Thank you, Satan.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
Did I win? I won? Thursday. Dude, are you serious?
All day this Thursday, exclusively from your walk right in free station, 101.
Who are you?
WRIF.
Credit card debt. It doesn't go away on its own. But what do you do if you're maxed out, in a jam, or going through a tough period? You didn't want to get so deep in debt. But now, how are you going to get yourself out? If you have over $12,000 in credit card debt, call Debt Settlement USA. They're the specialist at restructuring excessive debt into an affordable plan. Debt Settlement USA isn't bankruptcy or a loan program. They represent you and negotiate significant reductions with your creditors so you get out of debt faster and more affordably than you could on your own. If you have over $12,000 in credit card debt, call Debt Settlement USA for a free consultation. Call 1-877-560-8877. Your call is completely confidential and there's no obligation. Not available in all states. You can get out of debt faster than you think. Call Debt Settlement USA right now. 1-877-560-8877. That's 1-877-560-8877.
Do you want a wireless laptop but your credit score is holding you back? We can help. Guaranteed. If you have a bank account and can afford weekly payments of just $29.99 for 12 months, we'll send you a brand new wireless laptop no matter what your credit looks like. Call Tronics Country now. You're approved for a brand new Dell or HP laptop. Call now and we'll also include a free MP3 player and free LCD TV with your paid order. Call 800-990-2258. Still not sure? Then hear what our customers say.
I'm really enjoying my laptop.
I just wanted to call to say how happy I am with it.
And I'm very pleased with their service, so I would suggest to anyone that is looking for computers or trying to find computers, Tronics is the best place to call.
Call now and lock in your free gifts. You will not be turned down. Call 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome back. And Jalene Jordan as well. Someone might be thinking, why did I say thank you, Satan? Because we were playing this stupid video that says when you, if you take Barack Obama saying, yes, we can, when you play it backwards, it says, thank you, Satan, if you just Google thank you, Satan. I mean, it's so patently stupid. But it's kind of funny. Let me see. I just kind of randomly put a head.
That someone did it.
Yes, we can. Thank you, Satan.
Sub-Earth.
Thank you, Satan.
Wait a minute.
Sub-Earth, the knife, the snare sooner. Thank you, Satan. Sub-Earth, the knife, the snare sooner.
What is that?
And a democracy was saved.
Sub-Earth.
Yes, we can.
The mark is sooner, yeah.
She was there for the buses in Montgomery. Here, Mike, I'm just up for the fans.
Thank you.
So we surrounded them.
Composite self for the feral Zeus. Thank you, Satan.
Thank you, Satan.
Thank you. So Joe from Flint.
Wait. Oh. Joe from Flint?
We were talking about Led Zeppelin. He said it's from Stairway to Heaven, and they got to leave for Satan is clearly audible earlier in the song is what he said.
Well, who knows those guys, because they were into, oh, man, and now everybody's going to email me. They were into this guy who was sort of, I don't remember if he was Satanist or what.
Oh, Aleister Crowley?
Yeah, right.
I don't know that they were into him. I think they probably went to his house or something.
That's sort of the, thank you, Satan. Thank you, Satan.
We shall overcome.
We shall overcome. Yes, we can. I love that man's voice.
I cannot believe you are still playing this.
Women don't add, it's just name.
Women don't add, it's God's name. Thank you, Satan. Market will lash you. Marker will lash you. One more. Marker will lash you.
What does that mean?
It means nothing.
Yes, we can. America, we have come so far.
Oh, I'm not playing that one. Never mind.
Time for you to end it.
Yeah, that would have got me in a lot of trouble. Anyways, just go to the Google, as W said, and do thank you, Satan. And if there is anyone out there that listens to this and says, oh, it's true, because I don't even understand the process. You'd have to really think there's a devil active in human affairs, and he's disguised. I mean, this is this old anti-Christ stuff. But how would they, what would they do? Be signaling covertly to the followers of Satan? I mean, it's so stupid. It's just, but it made me laugh.
I guess.
It made me laugh. Speaking of Satan, Dick Cheney, when are they going to indict that guy for all the crimes that he's committed? The Central Intelligence Agency withheld information about a secret counterterrorism program from Congress for 8 years on direct orders from former Vice President Dick Cheney. The agency's director, Leon Panetta, told the Senate and House Intelligence Committees. Well, let's back up on this. He withheld a secret counterterrorism program, which is the law requires that the president make sure that intelligence committees, quote, are kept fully and currently informed of the intelligence activities of the United States, including any significant anticipated intelligence activity. So Cheney directly broke the law, but do you realize what two words are before this man's name? Vice President. Who the hell gave him the power to do anything? How could the Vice President of the United States give orders to the Central Intelligence Agency?
And we all know he ran the show. He got away with anything.
Well, we used to say that Bush was Cheney's sock puppet. He had his hand up his back and all that. I mean, that's one thing politically. But when the processes of the Constitution are contravened, there's not much of a role for the Vice President in the Constitution. I mean, he's there in case something happens, as it's occurred on a number of occasions in U.S. history. But this man so dangerous to our form of government. And so you might say, well, you know, he kept us safe. Well, it turns out even the Bush's illegal program of wiretapping without warrants, is there still a Fourth Amendment that says you can't do that? He says, the Bush administration says that it's a vital tool that saved lives. I mean, the statement was made, right? I mean, that's what they said. And you get these right-wing conservatives that claim they have some respect for the Constitution, but when it comes down to somebody violating it directly, I mean, the fundamental statutes, if you will, of it in the Fourth Amendment, there, well, you know, there's an exception here. I hope that no one takes an exception, for their rights. But a new government review released Friday said the program's effectiveness in fighting terrorism was unclear. The report, which was mandated by Congress, and it was produced by the inspectors general of five federal agencies, found that other intelligence tools used in assessing security threats posed by terrorists provided more timely and detailed information. Most intelligence officials interviewed, quote, had difficulty citing specific instances, quote, close quote, when the National Security Agency's wiretapping program contributed to success against terrorists. So here was this violation of federal statute, this trashing of the United States Constitution by George Bush and Dick Cheney and all their underlings, and it didn't even produce any results, because in many ways that's not what they were about. I mean, sure, they didn't want to. Well, am I sure? Let's say they said that they did not want another attack on the United States. Why do I hesitate like that? Because if there would have been another, I mean, it would have been a double-edged sword. On one hand, they could have stepped up their executive powers, and that's what this is really all about. A senator from California, Dianne Feinstein, said that very possible that that the law was broken. According to Feinstein, we were kept in the dark. That's something that should never, ever happen again. And she said, along with Patrick Leahy, who is the chair of the Intelligence Committee of the Senate, said that the prior administration broke the law by concealing a CIA counterterrorism program from Congress. It's called checks and balances. It means that one branch is not superior to the other. And the branch, of course, that was the most feared by the founding fathers was the executive branch. I mean, it's been in the last 60, 70 years that the executive has taken more and more power upon himself. That it's been expanded, and it was sort of necessity, war, the depression of the 30s. But you had here a purposeful expansion of what these right wing creeps called the unitary president. Hello, whatever happened to Congress and the judiciary? Oh, they're out of here.
Right.
That is, by the way, a prescription for dictatorship, of fascism. And you say, oh, well, you know, we never got to that. That sure wouldn't happen. It can't happen here. Don't bet on it, dear friends. And don't bet that these right-wingers, remember, the conservatives always backed the fascists in Europe and here as well in the United States during the 1930s. They were very, very fond of the fascists. Henry Ford was a big fan of Adolf Hitler, as many of you probably know. Hitler had a photograph of Henry Ford in his bunker in Berlin at the last days. In fact, Hitler credited Henry Ford's donations in the early 1920s with saving the German Nazi Party from extinction.
And we're not making this stuff up.
We are not. Go to the Google.
Right.
All right. 313-298-WRIF. It's our number here. Boy, everybody wants to talk about stuff related to the economy and unions. So I guess we won't talk about backward masking of Barack Obama tapes anymore. Leave that to the right wing whack jobs. Here's Gabe is in Allen Park. Gabe, hi. It's Peter and Jeline. You're on the air with us on WRIF. Welcome.
How you doing today?
We're good.
Part of the reason I called was earlier in the show, your first caller talked about him wanting to run for a union position due to the fact that the International Union does not have voting rights for their members as far as the higher offices. Well, that goes as well for the regional positions, which actually hold more authority over the locals than the international does, because that's where you have to go through in order to get anything done for your local.
The regions.
Yes.
Right.
So, like myself, I work at UAW Local 372, and for us, we have to go through Region 1A, which is over in Taylor on Telegraph.
Sure.
And what happens is every 2 years we have a constitutional convention, which is nothing more than a coronation for the top executives. And basically what happens is when you walk in, they tell you who you're voting for, and if you don't fall in line, you are then basically over the next few years, anytime you go to the region, I mean for anything, it could be as small as we want to hold, you know, a picnic on your grounds or borrow the auditorium, you will be shunned. That's just the way it is.
Well, I remember when Jalene and I worked for the UAW from 2000 to 2003. We actually worked for their broadcast division and most of the time broadcast from Solidarity House. And I have to say that I began to recognize really early on that the most the quality that was the most in high regard wasn't even competency, although there were a lot of competent people there, to be sure. But the main one was loyalty, right?
Yeah. Loyalty and nepotism as far as family goes, and it doesn't always have to be the direct descendant like a child. It could be a brother, it could be a last name from a child that came from a previous marriage or a stepchild. That happens a lot, especially in those positions at those what they call appointed jobs, which are jobs that are given to favored people, and you never have to run for an office. And once you get your 10 years in there, even if you came from the floor in one of the plants or you started in one of the other plants or whatever the UAW represents, after your 10 years, basically you're given a double pension. So you're getting a pension from the company and you're getting a pension from the UAW International Trust Fund.
Hey, Gabe, I mean, aren't you a little worried about talking like this publicly, given what you said?
No, not at all. But I'll be honest with you, the lack of leadership that we have at the Chrysler Department, it has been extremely sad. And that's why I'm not hiding behind a fake name. Anybody knows me, knows I live in Allen Park. They can go on the website, Local 372. My name and picture's on there as vice president. And it's disgusting, honestly. It's sad. You know, my parents put in over 30 years of the Big Three. My father-in-law put in 30 years of the at Ford. And what we've come to is basically we're on our hands and knees, and I know the economic times say we're in such a position, but it's just like eventually the membership themselves has to take a better control of the upper leadership. We don't have that. You know, there's some people that'll get their feelings hurt. Well, you know what? I'm usually that guy anyways at our local. So be it.
I'm sure, Gabe, just from what you said, I could tell without even asking that you know the history of the UAW, and people always say, oh, well, you know, you can't form unions in the midst of a recession. Hell, the whole union was formed in the middle of a depression and demanded all sorts of wage increases and working conditions and pensions and what have you, all that cost the company's money. I mean, it cost the company money, right?
The thing is that recently I just graduated from Wayne State University's labor school, and that was a breath of fresh air over the last year going to school there twice a week and dealing with the directors there like Dave Reynolds, Gail, and things like that. And I'll tell you, that opened my eyes to other unions, because in those classes you're dealing not just with the UAW, you're dealing with the the transit, where you're dealing with everybody, and you're dealing with the SEIU. And listening to the way that they run their locals and the way they run their unions, yeah, our top leadership does get paid less than theirs. There's no question about that. We have one of the highest or the lowest constraints as far as monies that are being paid out to the top guys.
Sure.
But the way that their leaderships are elected, even in the Teamsters, you know, every few years having votes by mail, soon to be by internet, they're going to do it that way. It was a breath of fresh air to see that other unions out there are actually doing things that are a little bit more constructive than we do in the UAW.
Well, you know, Gabe, I always notice that the shop floor guys are living in Allen Park and Taylor and Sterling Heights, and the UAW leadership is living in Pleasant Ridge and
Royal Oak.
I was thinking Indian Village, right near Solidarity.
Oh, right.
Well, I've been to some parties there, you know.
I
went, whoa, you know, because I actually, one guy said to me, nothing's too good for the working class. And I'm thinking, wow, nothing's too good for you, my friend.
Yes. Yeah. But also, too, earlier in your show, you were talking about Thaddeus McCarter. Now, I just want to, I'm sure you know that, but, you know, early on, while the auto bailouts were going on, which honestly I'm thankful they did go through, I think that some of the monies that were put towards the companies may have been a little excessive, but guess what? I still got a job, so I'm thankful.
Sure.
But Thaddeus McCarter, he did come to our region at a regional conference at Region 1A around a month and a half ago, and he did give a very good speech as far as, you know, supporting the unions. He was on CNBC, MSNBC, talking good about the local economy as far as jobs in his district, because he has a couple of Ford plants in his area in Livonia. But, you know, I don't know about his take on Obama. I just wanted to let it be known that he did give a good UAW slant as far as, the, you know, union jobs and workers.
Well, all right, Gabe, thank you. Keep stay strong and give him hell.
All right, peace.
All right, peace out. Bye, Gabe. Well, Jalene, I think particularly after that conversation, you and I are never going to work for the UAW again.
You're the one who opened your big mouth.
Them having a radio division wasn't a pleasant experience for them.
I had a great time.
Well,
that
yeah,
was fun.
There were the moments. There were the moments.
Yeah,
and then there
true.
Were the moments. Yeah. All right. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan, ex-employees of the United Auto Workers. That was a long time ago now. You know, we ended like in July of 03.
03. Gosh, yeah. That was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Seems just like yesterday.
You know, all right. Hey, are we in the air? Oh, yeah.
We are.
Yeah. Should I play more of that?
No, because you got an email from our friend Winston Smith.
Yeah.
He said, Peter, you really have a compulsive one going on tonight, and said you should slow down or people might think you're into the Peruvian marching powder.
Oh. Am I talking fast?
Of which G.W. Bush snorted up half the country's supply.
Yeah. Am I talking real fast tonight or something?
I really am not sure. I don't think you're talking fast. I think that you're...
Talking weird?
I think that you're... obsession with this backwards yes we can is throwing him for a loop.
Okay, the end of it. How easily I'm intimidated. I didn't realize what her name was. You know that woman that was ordered to pay about $2 million for illegal downloading? Yeah, she's actually asked a federal judge to reduce the damages, and her first name is Jammie, J-A-M-M-I-E.
Now, how... Okay, well...
That's a great name for downloader. Jammie.
Michael,
I'm Jammie.
Michael Jackson's kid's name is Blanket, so Jammie.
Isn't that just his nickname?
Well, yeah. You know, but I think it was still...
Oh, I mean, you're talking about Jammies.
Jammies.
I was thinking like jamming.
Oh, like jamming out? Okay.
Jamming out, yeah. But anyway, she must pay the recording industry $80,000 per song.
Yeah, and where did she just went to various sites, and how did she get busted?
I don't know, but they were going to let her go for about $30,000 or something like that, and or $200,000, I guess. Yeah, oh yeah, $222,000. I mean, what the hell? You know, if you say it's you got to pay $2 million, say, wow, why don't you make it $20 million? You know, what's the difference?
Yeah, really.
I might be garnishing her pay a bit, but. So it goes. All right, let's take a few more calls before our top of the hour break. And let's say hello to Manny in St. Clair Shores. Hey, Manny, it's Peter and Jalene on WRIF. Thank you for joining us. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
We're great.
Hey, for the record, a lot of people get this confused. St. Clair is actually different from St. Clair Shores.
Oh, did I say St. Clair Shores?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. It did say St.
Clair. I know the difference.
I know where St. Clair is.
St. Clair is lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a nice place.
I've been up there for, what's the restaurant right in the water? There's a few of them.
Well, there's Mike's Voyager.
And
yeah, Mike's Voyager. That's a popular one. My buddy works there. The River Crab is a nicer one.
Yeah, that's
Pepper
right.
Pepper Joe's that's a nice place too.
Pepper Joe's, yeah.
Yeah.
I've performed at the Voyager.
Oh, have you?
I have. I performed there this past St. Patrick's Day.
She's a stripper.
I know. I brought my portable pole and turned St. Clair crazy.
Oh, I missed that show, didn't I?
Actually,
I'm a singer.
She is a singer-songwriter who has one album under her belt and does a cameo on recently released, but it's hard for me to get a copy.
My father. Yes, I keep forgetting to give you a copy.
Okay, we're going to get that on the air. But I'm sorry, Manny. Go ahead. You're on. What's up?
I wanted to say a few things about the auto bailout.
Sure.
And how it impacted this state. Basically, the money went through, billions of dollars went through, and still the companies went bankrupt, and still jobs are being lost. But if you could take anything from this, it would be that the money was definitely if our auto companies needed that much money, it's definitely a thing that it was not stable enough, and it was a sign for Southeast Michigan to start looking for more work. And I think that's honestly what a message that people took up, and started running into like energy and stuff, something to not lose, like, you know, a time period where, of income, you know, to support families and everything. And, you know, my whole family's in the auto industry. You know, I got a father who's in GM. I got an uncle who's in GM, another uncle who, you know, owns an auto parts company. Like, my whole life is, you know, is impacted about on how the outcome of GM and Ford and Chrysler are, you know.
So are you saying the bailout was good or bad?
I'm saying it was good. It was just like anyone who frowns upon it, obviously, you know, they don't live up here, and or they're you know, they're right wing conservatives.
Yeah, you know, actually, I'll tell you, Manny, one thing that's interesting is that the auto bailout is very unpopular in the country as a whole. It was very popular here in Michigan, although, yeah, how many auto plants are there? Like in California and Illinois and Wisconsin. So I didn't really get that. And you know, everyone. Well, I'll tell you, some of the conservatives were true to their principles in that they said that the free market ought to reign and that these things ought to just crash. Well, again, it's like I said earlier about these financial institutions that created the mess, and so did the auto execs. Nobody in the trenches, nobody that's on the production line, nobody that's the skilled trades, nobody that's in these supply these suppliers created any of this. It was these expensive suited Republicans who running these companies and running these banks and whatever that got us into this. And it really makes so many people grit their teeth to think, you know, screw these people. They've been screwing us for years and doing everything they can to undermine our standard of living while, you know, they just enrich themselves. Let them go down the drain. And I'll tell you, that kind of mentality certainly affected me. But in the absence of an alternative, and a lot of these politicians and these right-wing commentators, I never understood what their alternative was other than to let it all collapse. And it's like I said earlier, that it very well could have dragged absolutely everything down with it. And we think things are bad now. I don't know. You know, we could be, are we going to have grass or weeds for dinner? I mean, it could get that bad, I suppose. All right, Manny, thank you very much. Appreciate your call.
Yes, I hope not.
Yeah, I hope not, too. Here's Clint Novi. Clint, hi, it's Peter and Jelena on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, what's happening? You know, he was talking about
yeah,
like Ford plants and this plant, and it's like every day I come down West Road going towards the Wixom plant, right? And there's a big dinosaur sitting there. It's been closed for 2 years, man.
It's sad. Right. Seeing that.
Yeah, it really sucks, and it's like I live right there, and it's like, what are they going to do with that thing?
I don't know. What can they do with plants of that size? I know oftentimes I go to, what's that, Wixom, what's that park in Wixom?
I have no
idea. Proud Lake, yeah.
And it's like you come down West Road and you go towards the Wixom plant, and you remember back probably years ago, and there was three ships there.
I know. You know, actually, I'll tell you. And this is kind of a weird deal, but all the trees started dying. You know, there were still three ships going, but all the trees started dying on the easement alongside of the plant. I thought, man, this is pretty weird.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know if that presaged what had happened. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. We got to take a break right now. That leaves a number of open lines for you. Peter Werby and Jelene Jordan, we're at 313-298-WRIF, which is?
313-298-9743.
Right back with our second hour.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this. Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
Rock. See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Super Tuesday on 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Is your debt getting bigger? Are you falling behind on your bills and receiving collection calls? Well, it's not your fault. Millions of Americans are buried in credit card debt because of a job loss, divorce, medical bills, or just bad luck. But now there's a way you can get debt-free faster than you ever imagined. Call Credit Guard of America today for free information, and you'll learn how you can cut your monthly payments by up to half, lower or even eliminate your interest rates, and stop the collection calls once and for all. For free information, call 1-800-709-6136.
We owed
$25,000 to the credit card companies. This year, we're going to be debt-free.
Credit Card of America won't just help you get debt-free. We'll even show you how to improve your credit status.
They helped me pay off 10 credit cards and rebuild my credit rating.
Call us today to learn how you can cut your monthly payments by up to half and get debt-free. For free information, call 1-800-709-6136. That's 1-800-709-6136.
All this weekend, you demanded it, and we're giving it to you.
I'll get your head out of the gutter.
The Riffs, best of Drew and Mike weekend. You told us your all-time favorite moments from Drew and Mike in the morning.
It went from, like, maybe I died and I'm in some forest.
I love my salad!
All this weekend, we're playing them back for you.
You must have been...
Oh, I was so bummed.
All in celebration of the return of Drew and Mike to WRIF this Monday. The Riffs, best of Drew and Mike weekend, exclusively on 101 WRIF.
Thank you, Detroit.
The Riff. 101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Jillian Jordan is with me till 1 a.m., and then I'll be interviewing two really good ones. Someone asked, why did you do this? This isn't very political, but on my website, which I invite you to go to, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com, peterwerby.com, I interviewed Gail Green, who is this author of women's studies, written books on Shakespeare, and she doesn't sleep. She's an insomniac.
Oh, really?
So she wrote this book called Insomniac, and she discusses the disorder's origins, the medical approaches, the social and personal consequences, and it's a really good interview. I'm going to play that one first. And then one I played, I don't know, a year and a half ago or so, I just found this, Mark Bauerlein. He's written this book called The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future.
And so it's probably talking about LOL and BRB. And
what the hell does that mean?
You know, how people aren't, kids aren't spelling things out anymore. Cool is K-E-W-L, and, you know, that's just part of it, right?
Well, you know what? This book, I think, was written before Facebook and certainly before Twittering, so that's not even in there. So we'll see how his predictions came. Also, on peterwerby.com is the Rolling Stone article I mentioned earlier, The Great American Bubble Machine, how Goldman Sachs engineered every major market manipulation since the Great Depression, and now they are making billions again. A video called Bombs Won't Liberate the Women of Afghanistan, and this one I like, war criminal Robert McNamara, who was Secretary of Defense during the the Johnson administration, the architect of the Vietnam War, who after a while realized there was no way that the United States could win, and that it was based on a pack of lies, just like the Iraq War was, and continued on. It says on the website, millions of Vietnamese and 50,000 Americans died horrid death. I'm sorry, I have to go change that. 60,000 is more like it. 60,000 Americans died horrid deaths in a useless war of which he was the architect. And an Alaska blogger says, Sarah Palin is a coward and a bully.
A coward and a bully, yeah. Okay, I'll go with that.
And a quitter.
She's a quitter.
Yeah. I told my dad I was going to stop raising hell, and he called me a quitter.
Yeah. I like it.
Also, the articles, from Vanity Fair, it came from Wasilla. Wasilla.
Wasilla.
Wasilla. Yeah. Do you want to talk Sarah Palin?
I've forgotten.
Where is it?
You betcha.
You betcha. Did you just wink at me?
I did.
You did. I like this article by Frank Rich. She broke the Republican Party, and now she owns it. Although he's GOP, the grand old party.
Mm-hmm.
Someone just with the grand old party of perverts. Man, these guys just keep getting busted more and more, don't they?
They sure do.
I would say.
While trying to protect the sanctity of marriage. Maybe it's research.
It could be. Actually, Palin's popularity, according to Frank Rich, in his column in yesterday's Sunday's New York Times says, and you can just go to nytimes.com.
Or you can buy a copy. I've actually bought a New York Times today.
They're like $5. Huh?
$6.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. According to the USA Today Gallup poll, no less than 71% of Republicans said they would vote for Sarah Palin for president. The overwhelming majority isn't just, quote, the base of the Republican Party that liberals and conservatives alike tend to ghettoize as a rump backwater minority. It is the party, or pretty much what remains of it in the Barack Obama era. That's why Palin, he says, won't go gently into the good night, much as some Republicans in Washington might wish. She is not
and
just
others.
Yeah, she is not just the party's biggest star and most charismatic television performer. She is the only star and charismatic performer. Most important, she stands for a genuine movement, a dwindling white non-urban America that is aflame with grievances and awash in self-pity as the country hurtles into the 21st century and leaves it behind. Palin gives this movement a major party brand and political plausibility that its open-throated media exhilarate, exemplified by these right-wing guys. She loves the spotlight, can raise millions of dollars, and has no discernible reason to go fishing now except for self-promotional photo ops.
Did you see that? She did interviews in her waders.
Yeah.
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 And you know these guys are like, oh, man, these right-wingers. Oh, that is...
She looks so hot.
She's so hot. I can barely take it.
I'd like to get into her
like
waders.
Rip off those waders and...
I would leave them on.
Hook that gal and...
You missed
you
that
betcha.
One.
What?
I said I'd leave them on.
I would too. I'd run the other way.
Well, you know guys.
Oh, yeah, true.
Yeah. But I don't know. No, she's like, couldn't handle her.
Yeah.
Anyway, the essence of Palinism is emotional, not ideological. Yes, she is of the religious right, even if she winks literally and figuratively at her own daughter's flagrant disregard of abstinence and marriage. But family values politics, now more devalued than the dollar by the philandering of ostentatiously Christian Republican politicians, can only take her so far. Oh, this guy's really writing up a storm. Philandering of...
I know.
The real wave she's riding is a loud, resonant surge of resentment and victimization that's larger than issues like abortion and gay civil rights. So, yeah, so these people that, some of who have it better than most, they are the party of resentment. And, you know, we're the victims, you know, where everything was okay in America until...
So angry.
And why, you know, I mean, it is, they're these psychoanalytic chicken poopers, whatever you would say.
Yeah.
They never really have the nerve to turn on their masters, so they have to look for scapegoats. Of color, of, you know, I mean, that's why they get so wonked out about gays and all that, you know.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And their racism, their internal. Well, there is. There's a lot of internalized racism out there, Peter, and it is, I don't know, sending people through the roof, really. People just cannot handle, let alone that Obama is a black man and is their president.
Yeah. Palin has been tweeting on her Twitter account since she quit the governorship of Alaska. The governor tweeted today, "Try this. Act in accordance to your conscience. Risk by pursuing larger vision in opposition to popular powerful pressure." She could write fortune cookies.
She could. She needs to just zip it.
And like bad pennies, all of these people in the ongoing saga of Alaska Brothers and Sisters, you know, that television thing is on it. Sunday night, probably.
Oh, with Sally Field. I know of it.
Yeah, Levi. So they never leave the stage completely. Levi Johnston, who, you know, was supposed to marry Bristol Palin but called it off. Said he did live with the Palin family from early December to the second week in January, and he says he heard the governor Palin several times say how nice it would be to take advantage of the lucrative deals that were being offered, including a reality show and a book.
Yeah.
Levi says, he was the hunk too, right? Wasn't he?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He's a pretty good-looking boy.
Yeah. She, Palin, had talked about how nice it would be to take some of this money people have been offering us and, you know, just run with it. Say, hey, forget everything else.
Which she's doing.
Yeah. He said he thinks book deals were really what appealed to Palin. He said, I think the big deal was the book. That was millions of dollars, said Johnston, who has had a strained relationship with the family. Yeah, I guess.
But says now things have improved. So keep talking, Levi.
I mean, he bangs the daughter. He knocks her up.
Mm-hmm.
And then he, you know.
He was bashing her on The Tyra Show, for crying out loud.
Johnson came forward, according to his lawyer, because Alaskans want to know why Palin has decided to resign. Asked if he would vote for her if she ran for president, Johnson said, well, I think she's a great lady, but after seeing what she did now, you know, leaving Alaska, I'd have to say no. Obviously, she's stressed out as governor. I mean, moving up to the vice president or president is huge. I just don't think anymore that she's cut out for the job.
The guy isn't a rocket scientist. The kid is not, you know. It's probably the only smart thing he said that very end.
Yeah.
She's not cut out for the job.
None of them don't seem real bright. Okay. Let's continue on. Peter Werbe, Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF. That's our telephone number. And here is John in Livonia. John, you are on the air. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much, Peter. What's going on with Dick Cheney now? Someone's out to crucify him or have a Senate subcommittee investigate some of his dealings?
Oh, no. I mean, Darth Vader, he's beyond, they can't touch. You can't touch me. Right?
Yeah, can't touch that.
You can't touch that, right? Yeah, no, he may finally face the bar of justice for all the crimes and the federal laws he's broken, the usurpation of the executive's powers, of which he has none, and the violations of the Constitution. How do you feel about that?
He's out of office and everything, and I'm a Republican for the many years. I've been a Republican since 1981 with Ronald Reagan, but I don't know, someone's out to throw him under the bus.
Well, that's a good idea. I mean, that's a good way.
Okay.
All right, throw him under the bus, yeah. All right, somebody should. I mean, if you let crime, crime's not punished, encourages people to do the same thing again.
You know what? Throwing someone under the bus is telling up. On someone. We already know this guy's a criminal.
Well, yeah.
We already know all of this.
Right. All right. Thank you, John. Appreciate your call. Here is Jeff Jefferson Westland. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Jeff, you are on the air.
How are you guys doing?
We're great.
Yeah, well, bring Cheney out to the curb. I'll push him under the bus for
you. Okay. This is the metaphorical bus, right? Not the right.
Yeah. Okay. No, well, yeah. Whatever. Yeah, I was just calling. I know it's not your biggest favorite show, but I was watching Fox News today, and they were actually talking about the movie industry coming to Detroit, and that the girl that was on, she said that she was here in Detroit, and she was talking to a bunch of people, and they said it was really good for Detroit that it was going to replace the auto industry. And I was wondering if you guys thought that. I mean, is that going to be possible? I
don't know.
I think it's really going to help, and I think it's exploding before our very eyes for sure. But the auto industry is.
Yeah, I mean, think about.
I don't know.
Yeah, at its height, how many people the auto industry employed? I mean, not just directly in the big three, but all the supplier plants and everything else involved in auxiliary roles. And sure, I mean, I all of us love movies, and it's a heavily unionized industry, which will help keep the overall level of wages up. I mean, that's one of the reasons that Detroit was so prosperous, for instance, by the 50s and what have you. That the standard for wages, even in, majority of people were never unionized, but the unions set the standard for what one should expect when they go to work. So, hello. Any news is good news.
Yes.
Did you see Gran Torino? Did you see that movie, Jeff?
Yeah, it was a really good movie. I think they're making a lot of independent movies here, which is not great, but it's still jobs are up. Whatever.
Sure, well, it's not probably less union, but at the end of Grant, if people haven't seen it, it was set all over, filmed in Hamtramck and Royal Oak and Highland Park. In fact, at one point they were looking down essentially what was John R. right to the street where I used to live years ago on Fern Park.
Cool.
Which is just around Davison and the Woodward Avenue, for those of you who live in the city or know the area. And but then at the end of the film, in huge the title, I mean, much, usually they'll say little script on there, who did this and that, but big letters, it said, filmed entirely in the state of Michigan.
Nice.
I mean, you don't ever see that, right, Jeff? You don't see anything that says filmed entirely in the state of New York or what have you.
Well, they make they make a lot of movies that are like actually supposed to be filmed in Detroit, but they're not really filmed in Detroit. They, I mean, because it was too expensive to do that because of the laws or whatever. But now I don't think that they do that anymore.
Well, there's a brand new HBO series called Hung, H-U-N-G. And was I talking about this on the air last week?
Mm-hmm.
But it opens up with, it's set in Detroit, and it's one thing. It's kind of strange because the protagonist, the guy, the hero, I guess you'd say, the anti-hero, he's walking down the street and he's throws his suit coat, or he takes his tie off and he throws it away, and then he takes his jacket off, and he keeps walking, and finally by the time he gets to his house by a lake, he's naked and he just jumps in this lake. But interestingly, I mean, it starts, I mean, you know, they'd strung together, like he walks by Tiger Stadium and they're demolishing it, he walks by Lafayette Coney Island, he walks by the old, you know, Michigan Central train station down around 14th and Michigan. So obviously, you know, you wouldn't walk in that direction, and you're not going to walk anywhere from downtown Detroit and wind up with a, you know, an inland lake like.
Are you going to walk a really long way?
Yeah, yeah. All right, Jeff. But thank you. I appreciate your call. I don't know if anyone else who's in the biz has that's listening that has any anything to say about the movie industry coming here. But to quote a very awful man, bring it on, right?
Mm.
Yeah, maybe that's not the right thing to say. All right. Here is Mike in Farmington. Mike, it's Peter and Jolene. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, what's going on? Earlier you were talking about the downfall of the big three and the economic state.
Yeah.
I believe that this economy is never going to get better until you take the power out of one of the private-owned banks. And you might know this bank, the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve is no federal more than Federal Express.
It is much more than Federal Express. I mean, I mean, you know, right now the Federal Reserve, to some extent, has lost a lot of its power to determine monetary policy because they've brought the rates down to almost zero. But you know what? I mean, you got. I mean, I've heard this. I've seen these videos and all that. You're putting too much stock in one aspect of how this economy functions and whose benefit it functions in. And the prevailing idea is if we got rid of the Federal Reserve, the country would return to the people like it was before the Federal Reserve. The only thing wrong with that is total myth. I mean, if you go back to 1912, you know, workers were starving. They worked 12, 14 hours a day. There were hundreds of lynchings. The country was about to go into a war, had been in a war 12 years before. There were horrible depressions during the 1890s. And, the Federal Reserve is a quasi-governmental organization. Should it be more transparent? Should people know what the hell's going on? Yeah, but, I mean, how do you think that that financial and monetary policy should be set? I mean, there ought to be something like the Federal Reserve, if not that.
Huh? Yeah, but it can't be a private-owned bank.
I don't know that it matters. It like I say, it has a quasi-governmental aspect to it because it's regulating money, the monetary flow, and it tries to stop things, although it wasn't very successful in stopping the depression in the 1930s, obviously. But if someone said, "Hey, we're getting rid of the Federal Reserve, or we're making it, we're nationalizing it, and not making it, we're not letting it have this private aspect to it," I don't care. Fine. But it's kind of weird. The same people who are against nationalization, saying that's socialist, in other words, government ownership, are the same ones that saying they shouldn't be a private or a quasi, private Federal Reserve. I mean, there's almost always, in most countries, a national bank that sets those kind of policies, so things aren't left to the market, because as it is, things left to the free market, things always collapse. I mean, that's what Reaganomics. I mean, we are suffering now 30 years of Reagan economics that these moron free marketers always wanted. And do they want more? They want to have nobody regulating monetary policy? Well, yeah, you know, we can go back to the Stone Age, I suppose. All right, Mike. Talk to you. Thank you. Bye. Let's see. Here is Joey. Joey's in South Lyon. Joey, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, we're here, too.
Yes.
Hey, what's going on, man? Hey, you want to talk about, like, you know, like you're talking about Bush and Cheney and stuff. Yeah, I'm a United States Marine, all right?
You're what?
I'm a United States Marine, and Bush and Cheney, yeah, they did criminal acts.
Mm-hmm.
But you want to know about real criminal acts?
What's that?
Like stuff, like
he said,
stuff,
do you want to know about real criminal acts?
Yeah, real criminal acts. Yeah, what are real criminal acts?
So, like, when I watch women get beat in the middle of the streets when I was on day four patrols, me and my squad.
Where is this?
It was in Fallujah, Afania, Huzaiba, Iraq, you know?
Yeah.
And we couldn't do nothing. I mean, and then, like,
You think the kind of patriarchal society in which women are so devalued, or at least in a public role in Arabic countries, is worse than Bush creating this war, invading a country illegally that sends you and others there to risk your lives, suffer wounds, you know, traumatic experiences that'll stay with many of the people for life, that's wound up killing somewhere between 100,000 and a million Iraqis? That's the biggest crime of all. That's a crime against peace. Bush and Cheney ought to be in The Hague in the International Criminal Court.
I sent an OP in this Iraqi guy's house, you know. I'll tell you the story right out.
That what?
It's me and my squad Mark Kenty. So we're sitting there chilling, you know. Like, we're like, sometimes we'll just, like, we go in and we're knocking it over, like, hey, you know, Mada Shubi, that's Arabic for Marines, you know. Hey, can we come in? And we sit inside for, like, 24 hours, 48 hours. We have the dessert for, you know, in certain activities that did it.
Do you think this is okay for foreign troops to enter somebody's house? I mean, how would you like it if in Clarkston all of a sudden about, 20 Chinese troops said, can we come in? We want to stay here for 24 hours.
No, that's simple to story, you know.
So, you know what? I'll tell you, Tom, I'm really interested in talking to you, but I'm having an extraordinary amount of difficulty hearing you. You know, we're some open lines. Do this. Call us. Wait a minute. I don't even mean to do that. I'm sorry. Did I put you back on hold? Call us back. Try calling us back, because I'm having a great amount of trouble hearing you. I'd like to hear what you have to say. All right. Or wait a minute. Maybe this is somebody else. Is this Tom?
Doing.
Okay, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I just heard you speak about, like, Iraq and everything, and then you said something about the Federal Reserve and the amount of power that it exerts is, like, maybe overhyped. Is that what you were trying to say? Is that what I heard correctly?
I'm saying in a period where they can't adjust interest rates, the kind of power over monetary policy is obviously reduced.
It's reduced?
Yeah.
Okay, well, now, if you want to talk about Iraq and you want to talk about atrocities and killing, why don't you talk about the amount of jobs and suffering all these people have gone through over the past 100 years while the Federal Reserve has, I mean, devalued the dollar. You want to talk about something that's caused collapse. Let's
you really think that everything that's occurred is a result because they have this institution that the wealthy elite of this country, in order to manage the capitalist economy that benefits people in a real pyramidal way, that things would have been different if there wasn't a Federal Reserve? What would have been different?
What would have been different is the fact that your dollar wouldn't have devalued 95% over the course of about 100 years.
Well, I don't know whether... why do I have you at your word that would occur? I mean, this is, that all the entire world economy has expanded in an inflationary way. I mean, I don't have any... I'm not defending the Federal Reserve. I'm telling you that this is a mechanism that the wealthy financial interests set up to attempt to manage to some extent, the affairs of the economy. Have they done a good job? Well, no. They haven't done a good job for you and me, because their interest is not you and me, but it's the wealthy elite of this country. But if they didn't have that, I don't know that things would have been any different. In fact, they could have been worse.
But you're going to put a privatized institution backed by the United States government to monitor your your currency. That's a great idea, in your opinion?
Well, why is it a bad idea? What I'm saying is, what if it would have been completely a government institution? It would have been a national bank that did this, like happens in other countries. I'm saying that the nature of the capitalist economy is boom and bust, inflation, huge expansion of wealth for a small percentage of the population, and to focus on this one facet of it doesn't allow for a look at the big picture. The big picture is, how is wealth that's created in this country distributed? And it's distributed in this country and particularly in the rest of the world, and not all countries, but you know, if you start to get into the entire world, disproportionately towards this small little sliver of people at the top, when there's enough wealth to not have poverty, not have the kind of plagues and illnesses and what have you that occur. So the Federal Reserve, man, is like some little footnote of the American economy. And you want to get rid of the Federal Reserve? Get rid of the Federal Reserve. What are you going to put in? What manages monetary policy then? What would
a free market, man.
The free market. You know what's happened to the free market? That's called Reaganomics. Damn thing has fallen flat on its face. Because what happens is the robber barons, that's what they tried to get somewhat away from. The robber barons dominated the economy in the 19th century. They had depression after depression after depression. And there was some attempt to manage the economy through monetary policy controlled by a centralized organ, the Federal Reserve. Why they didn't make it completely a government institution, I don't know enough about the history of it. But for one thing, it's never been a free market except for labor. And that is when there's not a union, then they try to get our wages at the prevailing market price and try to drive it down as much as possible. When we either get laws like there is to have a minimum wage or that people organize into unions to artificially raise the price of labor, well, then, you know, maybe you get a decently compensated working class and you actually can create something of a middle class. But I'll tell you, with a free market, that benefits the very people who I think you think are responsible for this.
I mean, you just went on about a 20-minute tangent, didn't let me respond to anything. This is what you do every Sunday night, Peter. You goop up so much of a response, and then you take it to some other extreme. And I'm trying to tell you right now that the reason why you're not allowing a free market to work is because you have a centralized, backed by the government, freaking bank, man.
That's nuts. That's absolutely nuts. For one thing, there's a tendency in all of capitalism towards monopoly. If you haven't noticed, there a free market is about indistinguishable sellers, and you know, that as a whole definition, there's not been a free market. That the elites, the ultra wealthy, have as its mechanism the government of any country, and what we've had to fight for as common people is to try to eke out some decent guarantees that are put into federal law that would stop child labor, not allowing any time off, you know, pensions. I mean, a lot of that's going down the drain. I mean, it's nothing to do with the Federal Reserve or anything like that. It's, you know, how are the average person, how are they going to fight for their rights and through what mechanism? And it's like I say, you want to get rid of the Federal Reserve, get rid of it. And I'll tell you, you think I'm nuts. You talk about getting less regulation, I mean, it's goodbye economy, and goodbye to you, my friend. Bye. By the way, a lot of people feel cheated that they don't get to respond, like I didn't let Tom and all that, but I hate to say it, but that's the nature of talk shows.
Yeah. It is.
Yeah. I've called talk shows and thought, wait a minute, I got more to say, and I'm gone.
And then you know how everyone else feels.
Yeah.
We've got an email that Kim Cattrall, you know who she is. She's the one who played the kind of wild one in Sex and the City.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. She just finished a film entirely in Westland, Romulus, Detroit, and Livonia, and it's called Meet Monica Velour.
She wrote us?
No.
Oh. Oh, you just Googled this.
No. This was an email someone sent in.
Oh, okay.
This is since we were speaking about the movie industry in Michigan.
Yeah. All right. I forget. Which is it? Zeitgeist? Is that the film about the Federal Reserve? Is that about 9/11?
Well, there's Zeitgeist and Loose Change.
Yeah. Spare Change? Loose Change.
Loose Change.
Loose Change.
Loose Change, I think.
Yeah, Loose Change. Yeah. I don't know. Spare Change used to be when Harvey Obshinsky, who founded the Fifth Estate and a lot of other, the newspaper and a lot of things like that, his first talk show on WRF was called Spare Change, so it must have been Loose Change.
Ah.
And that makes, you know, one of the things is that people watch these things, and, you know, you have no way to check. I mean, think you could say the same thing with a book, but you got a little capacity, a little greater capacity to evaluate what is being written than you do when these images are just being flashed at you. And one of them starts off, like I say, you know, whenever it was, and I forgot actually the date, maybe it was 1912, that, you know, 1912, America was a free and prosperous country. I'm thinking, man, are these people ever read history? I mean, are they out of their minds? I mean, so it begins with an absurd premise. And,
And Richard wrote in, Reaganomics equals trickle-down prosperity. Obamanomics equals trickle-up poverty and the Fed.
Has no meaning.
Okay.
No meaning to me. You can get your opinions heard, although I have to say, sometimes they may be cut off. We should have a... Roger, maybe you should say. Roger's our phone screener. Thank you, Roger. Let's give Roger...
thank you, Roger.
Yeah. Maybe you should say, Peter, may end the call without saying goodbye. Or something like that.
We're trying to get him to whiz through these phone calls, Peter.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't have too much of a speech.
There you go.
But we do have open lines.
Yes, 313-298-WRIF.
Oh, 313-298-9743.
And both Jalene and I will be off next week. We will not,
we will not be here.
So there will be Riff Rock and Roll. Remember, Drew and Mike, Drew Lane returns to the Drew and Mike morning show tomorrow morning. What do they say? They start at 5:30?
5:30.
Mm-hmm. How do they do it?
I don't know.
Let's see. Okay. I'm just reading something that Roger wrote, but I won't say it on the air. Here's Steve in Westland. Steve, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. Welcome to the show.
How are you guys this evening?
We're good.
I am calling about this logical fallacies of the Republican Party and these right-wing whack jobs that want to sit on the Internet all day and explain the Federal Reserve is the root of all our problems.
Yeah.
First, their first accusation is that all this money we borrow has to be paid back in interest to the Federal Reserve. Well, who borrowed that money? In 1980, Reagan came into office. He had a $300 billion debt. By the time he left, it was $3 trillion.
Yeah, yeah.
Which the first and another two. The money collected in interest on that money is what Clinton had in his presidency, and then King George II here just doubled it again to $10 trillion. They scream about inflation. They don't understand that the inflation has already taken place, and the dividends and the grotesque pay packages of these CEOs while the worker got undercut and stolen from. And then they sit on Fox News and they talk about generational theft. Well, my friend, the theft has already taken place.
Sure it has.
And they're a bunch of cowards that don't want to stand up to the people who thieved it from us.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, because they know better than to confront their masters. So they just get cockamamie theories about one institution within the economy or a group of people or something like that. And it doesn't really create the capacity for us to solve problems, to find out where what's going on here. Why is this the wealthiest country in the world? And we can't pay our bills. The city of Detroit, the state of Michigan, the state of California. I mean, people love to say, "Oh, Jennifer Granholm, she's responsible for sending the Michigan down the tubes." Well, is Arnold responsible for sending California down the tubes? I don't think so. It has to do with the economy, mostly the economy, at least most wealthy executives, stockholders, the big ones and all that are Republicans. And my voice just kind of went up a few octaves there, didn't it?
It did.
All right, Steve, thank you so much. I appreciate your call. Thanks for joining us. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Brian in Centerline. Brian, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air with us. Are you Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Go ahead. You're on the air now, Brian. Go ahead.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah.
How are you doing? First, I'd like to say I listen to you guys on Sunday nights when I come home from work. It's a great show. Love it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I did hear you guys talking earlier about the local film community.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I actually have a friend who runs an indie film project that she has created. She runs it in Royal Oak. It's like second or third Wednesday every month. And they run 5 or 10 minute indie films, and there's about 10 to 12 of them, depending on what she can get set up. Now, I'm not just going to drop in and do like a little blurb here unless you guys want to know what the name of the project
is. Sure. No,
no.
Tell us and tell us where people can hook on to it.
It's the Main Arts Theater. Right on Main Street in Royal Oak.
Yeah.
Called the Mitten Movie Project. I kind of stumbled across her through friends and actually have been involved as an extra in a couple of small time, you know, local indie film projects. One was a TV show, one was a small movie. But she runs all sorts of local indie films at this show. It's a Mitten Movie Project. Her name is Connie Mangelin.
When is it?
I think it's the third Wednesday of every month at the Main Art Theater, and the shows start around 6 or 7, and it's $10 to get in, and you get about, you know, 8 to 12, depending on how many you can line up for that month.
Really? You know,
yes.
One of the things they used to, back in the day, they used to have they'd have film societies would actually, like at a university or sometimes the same thing at local theaters, they'd rent space and they would show movies that generally didn't get shown, either, you know, kind of like sort of like indie films or older films. The problem is now you can see just absolutely everything. I mean, you know, if you got Turner Classic Movies and HBO and
Netflix.
Netflix, yeah. So it's really undercut that, and that's nice. I mean, I watch a lot of films like that because I love to watch films. But what it's really taken out is the sociability. That is to say, I mean, one of the things is that when you go to a film, you're there with lots of other people, and it's sort of a night out. I mean, it's that's great. I mean, I'm gonna check it out.
Yeah, it's a cool project. It's gotten actually a lot of response, and she actually is a production assistant who helps on a lot of films, and she uses her connections, and she really, really is a fan of the local indie film community.
Well, that's good. Yeah. Thank you for that information. I appreciate it.
No problem.
You have a good night. Bye. See, he got his whole statement in. I said goodbye and everything like that. The Main Theater, yeah, they have terrific films there very frequently.
Love that place.
Love it. Yeah. So that's in Royal Oak, Main and 11 Mile Road.
Yes.
A lot of good places to eat around there as well.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Well, let's take a break, and we'll be back with our final segment on WRIF. And a lot of time for your calls at 313-298-WRIF. Back some open lines, and we shall return.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this. Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Super Tuesday on 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Do you owe taxes to the IRS that you can't afford to pay? What will you do? Your tax problem will only get worse if you don't do something about it. If you owe the IRS or state at least $15,000, call American Tax Relief. They've helped thousands of people like you eliminate up to 85% of their delinquent taxes. Pick up the phone and call 1-800-493-8157. If you qualify, American Tax Relief can settle your tax debts for less than you owe. Remove penalties and interest, and get the tax collector off your case. As an honest, hard-working American, you do have rights. Don't let your tax problem get worse. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation and see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, you can save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Call right now. 1-800-493-8159. That's 1-800-493-8159.
How would you like to lose weight for free? Hi, I'm Steve Bostick for Right Size Smoothies.
And I'm Scott Johnson
For a few months now, we've offered an incredible deal to the public. Use Right Size Free for 2 full weeks and see how much weight you can lose before you pay for them.
But some of you haven't called, so we're offering one last chance to take advantage of this popular offer. These people called.
I lost weight within a couple days. Now I'm down 120 pounds.
A free trial sounded like a no-brainer, so I called. Within the first week, I'd lost a lot of weight.
I knew within a few days I finally found the answer. I've lost 44 pounds.
Right Size Smoothies contain an appetite manager that knocks out hunger cold. You'll see results early, so you'll know you can do it.
How much weight can you lose in 2 weeks? Try Right Size Free and find out. You could be our next testimonial.
For your free 2-week trial, call 1-800-644-1454. 1-800-644-1454. 1-800-644-1454.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. Eat the rich, out of the palace, into the ditch. That's what Crocus says. We are so much more milder than those folks.
We are.
We
and,
are.
Aerosmith said it, too.
They did. They did indeed. 313-298-WRIF is our telephone number, and House Democrats are going to ask the wealthiest Americans to help pay for overhaul that. May I start this sentence again? Okay.
You may.
House Democrats will ask the wealthiest Americans to help pay for overhauling the American health care system with a $550 billion income tax increase. I like that. They should pay for it. The proposal calls for a surtax on individuals earning at least $280,000 in adjusted gross income and couples earning more than $350,000, according to the chair, Representative Charles Rangel of New York. It would generate about $550 billion over 10 years to pay about half the cost of the legislation. And as the provision in, as the proposal envisions it, the rest of the costs would be covered by lower spending on Medicare, the government health plan for the elderly, and other health care savings. So that's good.
Yeah.
I mean, ain't going to hurt them too much. I don't think they're talking about taking away $50,000 or anything like that. And an individual making $280,000, these days you think, well, that's not exactly the biggest sum in the whole world. That puts them in the 95th percentile. In other words,
right.
they're in the top 5% of income earners. And in a country that has tens of millions of people without any health care and tens of millions more without adequate care. Remember last week we were talking, these people were calling in, this woman with four children, and she was paying something like $400 or $500 a month, and it didn't do her a damn bit of good. So I think the wealthy can afford a surtax. The other thing, we could afford almost everything if there wasn't this commitment to these continuing wars, this military presence in Iraq, and now this expanded war, which is becoming Obama's war in Afghanistan. And it's probably sad to say more Americans being killed over the weekend as the Afghan war heats up.
Yeah, I mean, there were four today alone.
Turns out that they counted them twice. It was two only. But only, imagine that. I mean, how would you like, someone said your son was
only. Yeah, it was only your son and your son. Yeah.
Last week in Iraq, only one American was killed.
Mm.
I don't know how many injuries, the injuries, there's been tens and tens of thousands of serious injuries in Iraq. But has come out as after a mass killing of hundreds, perhaps thousands of Taliban prisoners of war by the forces of an American-backed warlord during the 2001 invasion of Afghanistan, Bush administration officials repeatedly discouraged efforts to investigate the episode, according to the government officials and human rights organizations. Let's see, American officials had been reluctant to pursue an investigation sought by officials from the FBI, the State Department, the Red Cross, and the Human Rights Group. So this is who wanted to investigate the role of this American-backed warlord in this mass slaughter of every account I've ever heard of thousands. And what happened? These people who were simply foot soldiers of the Taliban army, and I'm sure probably didn't even know 9/11 occurred, didn't even know there was such a person as Osama bin Laden. It's not like everything is real connected there. And Osama bin Laden was up in the mountain. They put all these people in these huge containers where hundreds of them suffocated to death. And others were, once they were in there, these Afghan warlord soldiers paid for and supplied by our tax dollar. They just machine gunned them all, right? I think these people are a little pissed off. You wonder why they're so resistant to having the boots of American soldiers tramping through their land. And this is not, you know, this is not a criticism of individual soldiers. I mean, certainly a lot of the acts perpetrated by American soldiers in Iraq were criminal. Very few of them were actually prosecuted. But you know, it's what happens when you invade another country. When I was talking to that soldier, and he was talking about his platoon. You ever seen the, I mean, I've seen lots of photographs of that, of soldiers sitting around in someone's house. Can you imagine having a house full of Chinese troops or Russian troops because they came to your door in full battle gear and said, we're setting up here to, just for a little while. So, criticism of Afghan war is on the rise in Britain. 15 soldiers, British soldiers, have been killed in the last few days. Oof. And, of course, the country, when a modern war machine moves into your country, no matter now they're trying to say they're trying to reduce civilian deaths, you know, it's pretty ugly what occurs. And Allied officers concerned by lack of Afghan forces. So there's 4,000 Americans in this, what was it, some... I forgot the name of the well, you know, they always have these names for these things. Brigadier General Larry Nicholson says, what I need is more Afghans. Yeah, you think? You know, guys from Michigan and Texas are doing it. And he says, the net increase in Afghan security forces is zero. Well, that's nice. So, and the Russians, we were talking about this last week, said, yeah, you can use our country to go through
airspace
with a, you know, with the supplies for your war in Afghanistan. And I'm sure they were just chuckling, thinking, yeah, that's right. We were in there, too.
Yes, they were.
And so were the Brits back in the 19th century, who didn't do well either. So, let's go on with our calls. Here's Paul. Paul is in Plymouth. Paul, it's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Peter. I just wanted to add to your conversation about the film industry here in Michigan.
Yeah.
You know, I'm kind of upset that the media hypes all this up so much. And they're trying to make believe that this is the savior for manufacturing jobs. And they're pushing all these new schools here to train young men and women to get into this industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I've worked behind the scenes. I'm a location scout manager for feature films and commercials for over 10 years. And all these people are coming in paying these fees to be trained for jobs that just don't exist. You know, most films, there's 100 people on a film. There's one or two or three people in each department. Well, there's already people here that do that.
Sure.
And by charging these people $2,000 and $3,000 for classes to be a makeup artist or to be a lighting guy or grip, I don't know where they're ever going to find these jobs. I mean,
partly it's true in the radio industry and communicate. Think about all the communication schools and the private radio schools. I mean, in many ways, they're training more people than can be absorbed by the industry. But on the other hand, you know, there are people that actually get jobs and they have the training, and there is a turnover and there is advancement within the position. So there's new jobs opening up.
I mean, I think this is a great thing for Michigan. Don't get me wrong. Although I'm looking at the numbers over last year, Michigan, we had 35 films that were shot here. Most of them were independent films that I don't know if we'll even ever see. Those films spent almost $140 million. And with the 40% incentive, the state paid out almost $50 million in tax credits. So it cost us $50 million to bring in $140 million of revenue.
Mm-hmm. No, it's $90 million, not bad.
No, that's really good.
Yeah.
It just, you know, I don't know if it's all it's going to take. The only reason these films are here today is because we've offered the highest incentive rate in the United States. But, you know, now you've got Iowa, I believe, just a couple of weeks ago, they went to 50%. And you've got other states, they're going to do the same thing.
Yeah, sure.
And what will that do to all these people investing in infrastructure here, whether it's studios or equipment, cranes, everything you need to shoot films, who are banking on all this, investing all these hundreds of thousands of dollars, or even, I should say, tens of millions? what's going to happen to that if this all goes away?
Well, that's it. What, you know, we start chasing scarce dollars, as they say. There's no predicting, actually. Hey, Paul, tell us just quickly, you're a site. What's the phrase for your job? Your job
character? I'm a location scout and manager.
Tell us quickly. I mean, just give us an example. What a client wants to...
Let's say I want a part in a movie.
No. Well, I don't think that's what he does. If they want to do an ad for...
Oh, he's on location.
Yeah, an ad.
Like the house in Gran Torino. Did you find that?
Okay, sure. I didn't. Let's say you're the director, you're the producer of the film company. You'll send me a screenplay. I'll read it. Each scene has a number attached to it. There may be 50 different locations in that whole movie. There might be 100 houses, street scenes, barbershops, wherever, in a ballpark. I'll read through that. I'll break down the whole script, and then I'll go out and find those locations for the director. I'll take pictures. I'll take video. I'll get all the contact information. Then I bring all that back to the director, and he reviews all that. And if he sees one of those locations that he likes, I'll go back to the owner of that property, and we'll negotiate some sort of fee, location fee, for that property. And from that point on, if they decide to come in and shoot there, we'll have to set up a base camp nearby where we'll have hair, wardrobe, makeup, say a parking lot down the street that can be cordoned off for all the departments. Props, wardrobe, the camera department. We need a separate area. The Teamsters, for instance, will bring everybody from to and from the set. But my job would be to find those locations, set up those deals, and then when we shoot there, manage them so that they're either all propped up or dressed up for the scene. And then when it's over, we return them back to their original condition and move on to the next.
You know, Paul, I rarely have heard any job that I ever thought I'd like to do as much or as the one that I do, and you just hit on it. But don't worry, I'm not gonna go to school for training.
Sounds like a fun job.
Hey, Paul,
it's really a lot of fun.
It sounds like it. All right, thank you very much.
Sure.
Appreciate
Joe
the call.
Joe wrote in and said some classes are $5,000 for carpentry and set building.
Oh. Well, it's like, I think both things are true. Certainly Paul's caveat that, in anything you're being trained in. I mean, think of all the people that went to, business school. There was a big thing about that. Everybody thought, hey, I'm going to be on Wall Street. I'm going to make a ton of money. Same thing with radio and television training. I mean, what are you going to do? Say, okay, I'm not going to get any training. I don't know. If someone said to me, would you advise me to do that? I'd say, I'm not into the business of advising.
Good answer.
Let's see. Here is Chris in Ferndale. Chris, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air with us.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
I just wanted your personal opinion on our president. Are you happy that he is in one in office?
Well, I'm happy that those other two
Palin
characters.
Palin and McCain are.
Can you imagine,
life with those two?
Oh, man. Yeah. I mean, what we need is the people. The politicians aren't going to do it, and we're counting on the politician. I mean, Barack Obama is certainly a breath of fresh air on many levels, and they've rolled back some of the worst abuses of the Bush administration and returned a lot of it to the rule of law. But, I mean, certainly a lot of the old policies just continue through all the presidencies, whether it's a Democrat or Republican. But in this case, there was only two, and John McCain and Sarah Palin would have been a disaster, probably comparable to Bush and Cheney. What do you think?
I somewhat agree, but do you know rumor was that he spent almost $3.5 million on just extra security for his personal use?
When?
From what I hear, was about roughly a month ago.
Well, I suspect, Chris, whenever a president travels abroad, it costs us. Do you know what they bring with? I mean, they bring their own vehicles. And when the president goes to a G8 meeting in Italy or, stops off in Ghana or something like that, believe it, it's millions and millions of dollars, no matter who it is, whether it's Bush or Clinton or whoever. I mean, Dick Cheney had the whole of, he was in Al Gore's house, in the Naval Observatory, had maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars of renovations done there.
You know, I'm more angry about we have to pay for security for GW for 10 years.
Well, I mean, that's just part of the law. But, yeah, the presidency that it's developed into almost a position of royalty and hence a target for every whack job in the world, it pretty much necessitates all of that. So it's unfortunate, but, we're paying the bills. All right, Chris, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Here is Chris in Stockbridge. Chris, hi, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter, how's it going?
It's going good.
I just wanted to comment on the film industry in Iowa.
Okay. That would...
Yeah. I don't think they really have anything over Michigan. I mean, Michigan isn't anything great, but they kind of... they got a lot to work with as far as the... all the water and...
Yeah, I don't think...
That's true. I grew up in Iowa.
I was
going to
say, we're going to get a little...
I grew up in Iowa. And, really, it's... I have to say, in the main, Iowa and Michigan are quite similar, except for the water thing. That is the big factor.
Yeah, and,
but it's, a lot of agriculture, but a lot of bigger cities, mid-sized cities.
And the D.
And the D. This is the dirty D, and that's the little D.
Oh, yeah. You came from Des Moines, right? And there is some water. There's the Mississippi River.
Yeah. It's kind of funny. I grew up in Des Moines, and there's, the lake.
Yeah.
And everyone I know who has a boat, including my dad, they're all at the lake.
What's the name of it?
Sailorville.
The Sailorville Lake?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. My brother-in-law actually was in the Coast Guard and was assigned to the Mississippi River.
Really?
Yeah. Thank you, Chris. I appreciate your call. There's lots. I mean, you couldn't shoot Gran Torino in Des Moines, obviously, right?
Why not?
Oh, yeah, I don't know. Did they have any urban gritty scene? No.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Not to that extent, but you could find a block with a house,
Maybe you could.
It's
going to get down to being the bottom line, as they always say. And if what's going to happen? I mean, Iowa's going to give them 50%, and Michigan's, all right, we're going to up it to 52.
Right, yeah.
Well,
movie wars.
Yes. Radio friends, we're going to say goodnight. I want to thank you so much. Oh, I do want you to, to have misplaced entirely my...
Uh-oh.
You would think by memory, since I did the interviews, that I would know who is going to be the interviews, but it's going to be... Oh, yeah, the woman who...
Gail Green.
Who wrote the book on insomnia.
Now, that's my memory, and I've only heard that you were going to have her on once.
I got a...
Peter, you need me.
I do. I got a head full of ideas that are driving me insane. By the way, we ought to just give a little bit of information here that we failed to do, and that is that we have a Facebook page, which now is just what? Facebook.com/nightcall?
Yeah, go there. Now they have usernames.
Right, that's right. And my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com, has tons of stuff on it. There'll be a podcast available on the Facebook page and, of course, at wrif.com.
I wanted to say, Drew and Mike back together in just about 5 hours, 6 o'clock. Mark and Mike, the producers, come on at 5:30. Someone had from Flint, believe it or not, had emailed and said, I believe they come on at 6. And that is, they come on live at 6, but the show starts at 5:30.
We're usually sleeping.
Yes.
All right. And Jolene and I are both going to take the next Sunday off. So
we'll miss you.
Yes, we will. And we'll see you in 2 weeks. Stay tuned for the interviews.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Did I win? I won?
Thursday.
Dude, are you serious?
All day this Thursday, exclusively from your one ride-in free station, 101.
Who are you?
WRIF.
Time's running out. You're maxed out on your credit cards. The collection calls are coming every day, and now you're 2 payments behind on your mortgage. Every time you turn on the radio, there's some cheerful couple telling you how they got out of debt overnight. Their stress is gone, and everything's just wonderful. Come on. The truth is, what sounds too good to be true is too good to be true. You need real help, and you need it now. Not bankruptcy. That should be your last choice. We're Credit Card Relief, and we've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. We're the only attorney-driven program dedicated to helping you get out of debt in months instead of years, saving you thousands, and without risking your family home. We know what we're doing, and we don't make promises we can't keep. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Get out of debt. Call Credit Card Relief at 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. That's Credit Card Relief, 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282.
Hey, back to the show in just a sec. But before that, have you guys heard about this? There's this computer program that literally has newcomers to the internet earning tens of thousands of dollars. See, this program lets you start selling high-profit products on the internet using sites like eBay. Selling stuff like digital cameras and iPod accessories, even plasma TVs. Now, here's a part I think's interesting. You can make all this money selling products that you never have to see or store or pay for. And there's a company that's giving out a CD for free that tells you how to get started with it. The number for the free CD is, it's here, it's 1-800-900-8414. Looks like your computer does the work while you basically collect the money. Seems like an easy way to run a business out of your house. Anyway, to get the free CD, you call Internet Speedway at 1-800-900-8414. 1-800-900-8414.
101.1 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Peter Werby here with you. Thanks for joining me. I have a friend of mine who has insomnia, and one phrase I hear from her very frequently is that sleep is a wonderful thing. And most of us know somebody that has insomnia. That's it's pretty widespread throughout our society, and feel badly for people. Most of us who don't have insomnia have had sleepless nights or had issues that have kept us up, and we're sort of aware how distressing it is. But it's way beyond that, and it took a book that I recently received from the University of California Press called Insomniac to really give me a full idea of what it's all about. It's written by Gail Green, and Gail Green is professor of literature and women's studies at Scripps College. That's in Claremont, California. She's published books on Shakespeare, women writers, and scientific issues. And she's most recently published a book, Doris Lessing, The Politics of Change, and another book, The Woman Who Knew Too Much, Alice Stewart and the Secrets of Radiation. She's a member of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. That's a professional medical society for researchers and clinicians. And she's the patient representative on the board of the American Insomnia Association. We're reaching her at her home near Berkeley, California. Gail Green, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, people that don't have insomnia really do tend to underestimate its effect on people. Has that been your experience?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, people take sleep for granted. When it works well, they just don't even notice that it exists. And this has been a real problem because it means that research has not looked at sleep until quite recently. You know, it's the invisible third of life. It, you know, lights out, systems down, what's to talk about. So sleep has been very little studied. This, you know, attitude has gone to the scientific community at large until the middle of the 20th century when they discovered REM sleep and realized how very much is going on in sleep, how our brains are, you know, active and our bodies are replenishing themselves, and how important it's the fuel of life. Sleep is the fuel of life. So it's less taken for granted by scientists now, but still taken for granted by the population at large.
Mostly people consider it personal misery, but in your book, Insomniac, you list all the other effects it has on one's personal and professional lives. I wonder maybe you could expand on that a little.
Yeah, well, it is ironic that it takes an insomniac to really tell you, you know, how very important this is to your life, because when it doesn't work, I mean, you, of course, well, I mean, it affects the cognitive functioning. First of all, you don't have your mind. You can't, your attention, your memory, all of those things are, you know, severely impacted. And then your mood is just, people cannot, I mean, I've often been asked, Well, are you a cranky person? Because I say somewhere in the book, this is a cranky book. And I said, which me are we talking about, the me with sleep or the me without sleep? You know, I'm fine when I get sleep. When I don't get sleep, yeah, I'm cranky. Yeah, I'm irritable. I'm on the verge of tears or tantrum. But so's everybody, you know. And you know, when you drag sleep loss out over time, then you have a person who really, you know, does become psychologically impaired. The conventional explanation for insomnia is it's depression or anxiety, but people actually get that way when they can't sleep. So they're looking at the consequence of the disorder and you know, saying that it's the cause, which is one of the things I found in the book. I mean, that was one of my strong messages, was that this is not a, you know, we are, this is not a psychological disorder. This is actually just a physiological consequence of not being able to sleep. We do become psychologically a bit of a mess.
Well, you mentioned the downside to one's cognitive abilities and probably creative abilities, but Gail Green, you're a professor of literature and women's studies. You've published books on Shakespeare, on women's writers, scientific issues. So at least, and you have your 500-page book, Insomnia.
High function.
Yeah, well, I mean, we have like high functioning alcoholics.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, and I mean, this has been a lifetime of learning how to sort of manage it. It's also been an enormous amount of luck. I'm an academic, which means I get to structure my own hours. I don't have to be functioning at, you know, 8 a.m. I couldn't have done that. And the people I interviewed a lot of insomniacs for this book, and they were really wrecked by these schedules. You know, the 9 to 5, the 8 to 5 schedules are really demanding, regular, you know, kinds of work schedules that most people have. And plus, if you're a mother, I mean, if you're raising kids, that imposes a regularity of schedule. These are the people I found that were really the most severely impacted by this disorder. And there are so many of us, you know. I think I started this book with woe is me. Mm-hmm. And then I realized about halfway through, wait a minute, you're one of the lucky ones. You're an academic. You can structure your time. You can stand back and look at this problem. Other people don't get that privilege. They are really ground into this kind of, life in this society is pretty relentless. I mean, in terms mm-hmm. of the, you know, employers need to be more flexible, allow people to do work on their own time. I don't know what you do about getting the kids to school. You know, if you're lucky, you get a cooperative partner. But, I am functioning, but I've been very, very lucky, and it's taken me a lifetime to sort of learn how to do it. And I'm also not adverse to taking a certain amount of medication. And if you try to do it without medication, I think in some ways it's harder.
The book is Insomniac. Gail Green is my guest on the Peter Werby Show, and her website is sleepstarved.org. I'm going to give that more times than I normally do during a broadcast, because the insomnia is so widespread that I think probably a lot of you are going to want to go to that site. You know, actually, this is the first time in a long time that I've interviewed anybody where there was a one-word title without a subtitle. There's also, you know, it's usually Insomniac, the story of how people... do you expect, and has it been so that this really resonated with people, just that this one word on this sort of dark cover that suggests night and has a little quarter moon there?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I expected the press to give me some trouble about that, but they didn't, because it actually did say it all. I mean, what I do in this book is tell the inside story of what it is like to live with this disorder. Other people, there have been many, many, many books on insomnia and sleep, and they tell you they're written by experts, and I often feel that I'm putting experts in quotation marks here, that these guys have never had a sleepless night in their life, you know, and they don't really know what it's like to kind of have to function with it and to have to be on the next day and pretend like it doesn't exist. This is a great invisible disorder, too. I can maybe come back and talk about that, the invisibility of it, which means that people, you know, it's not like you have a pair of crutches or a cast or going around. I mean, nobody knows that you've had 2-3 hours of sleep the night before. I haven't had a whole lot of sleep last night. I have to confess this to you. This interview is not the easiest. But, yeah, so, I wanted to find out what the world looked like to insomniacs, you know, not only myself but the other insomniacs. So I went around and interviewed a whole lot of them. And as I say, I found out I really was one of the lucky ones. But I also wanted to find out what the science knew about this disorder. And it turns out very little. I mean, that was really a shocking thing about it. Well, it wasn't so shocking because I've been getting the same sort of dumb old advice all my life. And I thought, where is the science after 50 years? You know, I've been an insomniac ever since I can remember. My father was a doctor, so he would tell me sort of the conventional, you know, go to bed earlier, go to bed at the same time. You get so wound up, don't do. And, you know, when you hear the same advice for 50 years, you begin to think, where is the science? So that's the other question I had, you know, what does the world look like to insomniacs, but also what is the science up to?
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead.
Yeah, so it became a lot about the scientific, you know, state of the art on insomnia.
Well, let's do this. I mean, I rarely structure interview and just kind of let them grow, but I have a number of questions. If someone would have said to me, why do so many people that I know have insomnia, I would say, well, it's a product of the modern world. There's so much stress. There's so much noise. There's so much going around in what the Buddhists call our monkey brains that no wonder that great numbers of people don't sleep or have great trouble sleeping. And I conceived of this as completely a modern phenomena. But maybe you could speak to that, and also tag on to it what you call it a disorder. Maybe and you're a member of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. So talk about, if you would, it's modernity, if it or lack of it actually, and also what's considered to be the physiological or psychological origins of it.
Yeah, there's no question that life today is really not conducive to good rest. I mean, the demands, you know, placed on us, the anxieties, I mean, insomnia is up, you know, since last October, since the kind of economic crash. So it's obviously hooked into modern life. Also, modern life is unforgiving. I mean, if you live in a village, a third world village, there's just more, you don't have to be quite so, you know, functional so early, so there's not so much writing on it. Sleep, there's many more forms that sleep takes in traditional societies. And in, there's biphasic sleep. I mean, people sleep, you know, some in there's siesta cultures is the best known. But there's other forms of it, you know, where sleep just occurs in little pieces here and there. And the other, you nap during the day, you're up at night. It's more forgiving. They found that, you know, we probably slept in the past in this way. That sleep in an 8-hour consolidated block is probably a factor of the Industrial Revolution and electricity. I mean, that it, you know, it made us have to adhere to factory time rather than sort of natural time. So the modern world, yeah, is very sleep unfriendly, and there's also this kind of sleep machismo. Oh, you don't really need that much sleep, and the really tough ones that get to the top, they don't need sleep at all. You know, so we don't respect sleep. We don't have a kind of, we don't go with our body's needs. So yeah, all of that makes for, I think I would say probably a whole lot more sleep problems than there ever were in the past. Of course, it's difficult to know if that's really the case. But okay, having said that, there is also enormous variability when it comes to sleep. I mean, some people have stronger sleep systems and some people have weaker sleep systems. That's, you know, just the way some people are, you know, 6'2" and other people are 5'2". I mean, it's a physiological system. And there are, you know, morning people and evening people and short sleepers and long sleepers and fitful sleepers and deep sleepers. And the science is beginning to understand the genetic basis of these differences in sleepers. In fact, you've got some very interesting scientists right there at Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit who are really onto the way the sleep system works. And it's this huge variability, as with any physiological, biological system, you know.
This is physiological. That's what I'm wondering.
Yes, physiological. Okay. I mean, there are good sleepers and bad sleepers. And God forbid, you know, if you end up having a weak, fragile system in this society, you know, you put the two together and you really get a population where a third of the people are complaining about insomnia. That's a statistic. It's just huge. You know, I mean, you've got, you, I mean, some people are less endowed than others, well endowed than others. I mean, think of it. You know, we know this with the digestive system or the muscular skeletal system or the respiratory system. All of these systems, you know, people who have weak lungs, weak stomachs, you know, who, you know, we're different. We're physiologically different. And so it is with sleep. I mean, and, you know, if you have a fragile sleep system and then you are, you know, in a situation in this society which is demanding, you know, just demanding that you be on and functioning, I mean, you're going to get really kind of mangled by that. And a lot of people do. And this is why I think we have such a huge, you know, I don't think the sleep system has changed in over, you know, the eons. I mean, I think probably there always were fragile and stronger sleepers, but village life was more forgiving. It absorbed eccentricity more easily than our own society does.
Is there more of a, or is there also rather a psychological component? I know that people that have insomnia tell me they're fearful about going to sleep because they know they're not going to sleep.
Oh, yeah. Well, that can develop over time. Yeah, you really do become afraid of the bedroom because, you know, my God, you know, I'm going to have another sleepless night. And there are behavioral methods that can be effective with that, you know, to kind of break that cycle. You know, even this thing of like, you know, you look at somebody and you say, oh, that person is really stressed, you know, I mean, they ought to get a grip, they ought to... And, you know, often this is a physiological thing. I mean, there are stress systems that are more highly reactive than other stress systems. There are also people who are, you know, just type A, neurotic, crazy, you know, stressed, obsessive people who sleep like stones, who sleep just beautifully. I mean, it has nothing to do with the sleep system. You know, they're just like, I mean, I have several people in my own circle of acquaintance who I'd look at and say, if this person is like, you know, you would think this person would be an insomniac. And they sleep quite well. So that was one of the things that kind of broke that equation of sleep disorder equals psychological disorder. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Often no. I mean, more often than one thinks. That's one of the reasons I wrote the book. I didn't, you know, really wanted to say, bottom line, we're really not crazy, you know. We're differently abled.
Okay. The book is Insomniac. The author is Gail Green. She's my guest on the Peter Werby Show. Her website is sleepstarved.org. Sleepstarved.org. There'll be a link on my website as well. Peter Werby, that's W-E-R-B-E.com as well. You mentioned the part of the structure of this book, and we can talk about the other parts as well, because I'm sure there's some people that want to know some suggested solutions or places to go for. But you interviewed a lot of people. How did you find fellow insomniacs? Did you travel a lot? I mean, it's kind of unusual. So I want to talk to you about not sleeping. But tell us about those.
Yeah, this is a web-enabled book. I mean, I couldn't have done this without the web, you know. I mean, you just, well, I put it, first of all, I ran ads. I ran ads in, you know, kind of pricey places and got really, really fascinating responses. And then, of course, I would just talk to anybody, you know, on a personal, I mean, I became asleep. You know, I'd accost people in line at the theater, like, so how do you sleep, you know? Or I'd meet somebody who had some kind of interesting tick, like the guy who works on my computer who's just so tightly wound, and I'd say to him, so how do you sleep, you know? And he turns out sleeps very well. You know, so I just talked to everybody, and then friends of friends and students. I put out a huge thing at my colleges, and I got quite a lot of really, really interesting stuff from students. Who are not immune to this problem at all. I mean, you know, I mean, there's huge stress, a huge amount of pressure on young people, and they're just like, you know, they're responding as grown-ups do, you know, not sleeping very well. I just got a lot of really heart-rending stories of people who, and I still do. I mean, the reader mail I get about this book is just, it leaves me kind of like, because I don't know where to tell people to go. I mean, it's not like I can say, oh, there's this terrific person here, there's this terrific person here. I wish I could. But what I can say to people is do your own research, find your own way. Sleep is highly individual. We're all different in terms of the way we sleep and the terms of the way we don't sleep. You know, like I, for example, assumed that all women would have a hormonal link to insomnia because I always did. They don't. I mean, some women do and some women do not. So we're all, you know, highly individual. We have to find our own way. The web is a marvelous resource. You find out what works for other people. You try everything. You just simply bring it home and try it. And you may find the key, you know, that unlocks. I mean, I've got a whole lot of, I have a whole chapter on this in my book, and I've had people write me about things I haven't even tried in the book because I just haven't been, you know, gotten it together enough to try these, you know, vitamin cocktails and things that actually this, you know, people have found that, that they've worked. I use books on tape. I mean, when I wake up at night, I tend not to get up and do something else as the experts tell you you should do because that totally wakes me up. But I listen to a recorded book, and it often just helps me, you know, get back to sleep. Often does not, but it's a thing that people should know about. There are lots of ways out there, you know, but you have to find out what your problem is. If it is anxiety about the bed place, then you really should try these behavioral modification techniques. You know, troubleshoot your own condition. You yourself have to make yourself an expert in your condition. And there are ways, you know, people have found ways of dealing with it. So that's the hopeful message. It's not a one-size-fits-all solution. There are no one-size-fits-all solutions, but there are things that people have found that work.
You know, I wish you'd tell us a little about this column that you wrote for Tara Parker Pope's column called Well, W-E-L-L, in the New York Times. Let me see. Well, it was over a year ago. And you talked about humor. And, you know, that is kind of horrible. I mean, maybe I shouldn't make public confessions, but I almost could feel jokes coming up. Well, it's for your book, Insomniac, is 500 pages. You know, you probably had a lot of time to write it. Ha, ha, ha.
Ha, ha,
ha. But you speak to that. I wonder if you could just even kind of, I mean, it certainly immediately raised my sensitivity level, and although you realize I managed to sneak that one in. The little section in your column that you talk about, when if you say, I'm an insomniac, and then people say to you, about, you know, I go to sleep as soon as my head hits the pillow.
Yeah. Yeah, right. That's what I mean. It's the insensitivity to sleep. I mean, it's not. I don't mean people's personal insensitivity, horrible person, but it's a cultural insensitivity to it. You know, it's like, right. I mean, you wouldn't say to somebody, you know, who had some horrible health problem, "Oh, well, that's funny because I can, you know, run the marathon." You know, you wouldn't say that to a person. But if you meet an insomniac, you say, "Oh, my head hits the pillow and I'm out." We're just not, we're not cued into sleep. We don't respect it. It's not, you know, productive in our terms, and it's a waste. I mean, it's positively seen as a waste of time. I mean, my students say, you know, you snooze, you lose, I'll sleep when I'm dead, you know.
Yeah.
There's all kinds. I mean, they're working on their sleep machismo. But, yeah, the humor is, I mean, that's actually the first line of the book. The first thing to go is your sense of humor. I mean, it's kind of like this tread or this oil that, you know, this sort of lubricant for living that you just don't have when you don't have a night's sleep. And I thought it was just very important to get that across, because people who do have that tread and that lubricant, they don't get it. They just don't see that we're not dealing. It's not a level playing field here. You know?
Let me just expand. In your column, you quote British comedian David Baddiel.
Yes.
And he says, when people say to him, "Well, I can fall asleep right away," he says, "When I see someone in a wheelchair, I don't say, 'Really? Because I can do this,' and hops around the stage on one leg. Hey, look at that."
That was a great one.
Indeed. In many ways, you've already touched on what normally would be the end of an interview, and we're almost at it with Gail Green in her book Insomniac from University of California Press. And that was it. You said that essentially that people had to do their own research. And I don't know. I mean, do most people have strategies? I mean, personally, you know, without doing research, people say, "Oh, I'll take warm milk," or do people develop those, or do you think it really is important to expand their field of information about this certainly reading this book. I know who I'm giving it to.
Yeah, I don't know how to answer the thing about most people. I mean, people are at all levels, you know, with this in relationship to this problem. There are people who are just raw and what should I do, and I have no handle on it. There are other people who say, well, you know, I find that if I get up in the middle of the night and I just do a little bit of yoga or I watch a little TV and I don't get stressed out about it, I can usually, you know, manage and I'll, you know, sleep the next night or something like that, who've worked out, you know, attitudes about it. There's me that's, you know, I take a little bit of a short-acting sleeping pill for the second part of the night. I can usually get to sleep on my own. That's another difference in the kinds of insomnia, is there's sleep onset where you can't get to sleep, and then there's sleep maintenance where you can't hold, you know, can't continue sleep. I usually can get to sleep, but then I'm awake 2 or 3 or 4 hours a little later. Late night, I nibble off a little piece of a pill and listen to a book on tape, and you know, that way I sort of patch together 6 or 7 hours of sleep. So that's, you know, the way I've found to manage it. You know, this drug cocktail in my chapter 11. So there's just all different, you know, people are at all different stages with it. I mean, and it's just important to realize that many people have gotten a handle on it, and it is possible to live with it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the show. My guest has been Gail Green, and her book is Insomniac. It's from the University of California Press. They have lots of great titles, as you probably can tell by the number of authors that I interview from that press. It's ucpress.edu, and Gail Green's book, Insomniac, is there. But also, it's posted at sleepstarved.org. The book is there, and a lot of other material about insomnia. And it'll be linked on my site, peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E. Gail Green, thank you so much for being on my show.
Thank you.
Well, see, we didn't...
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this. Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Tuesday on 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Do you want a wireless laptop, but your credit score is holding you back? We can help. Guaranteed. If you have a bank account and can afford weekly payments of just $29.99 for 12 months, we'll send you a brand new wireless laptop, no matter what your credit looks like. Call Tronics Country now. You're approved for a brand new Dell or HP laptop. Call now and we'll also include a free MP3 player and free LCD TV with your paid order. Call 800-990-2258. Still not sure? Then hear what our customers say.
I'm really enjoying my laptop.
I just wanted to call to say how happy I am with it.
And I'm very pleased with their service, so I would suggest to anyone that is looking for computers or trying to find computers, Tronics is the best place to call.
Call now and lock in your free gifts. You will not be turned down. Call 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werbe here with you. Many of us have heard the phrase, the greatest generation. It refers to that generation of World War II that made so many sacrifices, both economically during the Depression and then during the war era. And there's been all sorts of generations since the X generation. Well, the boomers, of course, first, and the X generation, the Y generation. We're talking about the millennial generation now. But here's a book that came my way that I thought really brought up some issues that are very dear to my heart as well. The book's called The Dumbest Generation. How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future. The author is Mark Bauerlein, and Mark Bauerlein is a professor of English at Emory University in Atlanta. He's worked as a director of research and analysis at the National Endowment for the Arts. He's overseen studies about culture and American life, and also has had his writing appear in the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the San Francisco Chronicle. He's been on lots of TV shows, including CNN. CNN and the CBS Evening News. He's on the road with his book right now. Mark Bauerlein, welcome to the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you, Peter. Glad to join you.
Well, I'm kind of putting the cart way before the horse, because this you'd think would be at the end of this. But in your book, you say that we shouldn't worry, you and me, because I share a lot of these concerns that you do in the dumbest generation, that we shouldn't be concerned about being considered old fogies and ought to really address young people about the concerns that you have in your book. But probably the title doesn't invite them in, does it?
Well, it certainly doesn't, and we can add another subtitle for the book, which is Don't Trust Anyone Under 30. And that is, obviously a provocation. And it really lays out, I think, an attitude that more elders should take on this issue and a different approach toward the juniors in our society. People have said to me, look, Mark, older people have been complaining about younger people for generations. This always takes place. And I say, yes, they do. And for that to take place, I believe, is actually a healthy sign in any society. It's good for older people to criticize younger people for their ignorance and their inexperience and their hubris. And it is also a healthy sign for younger people to resent that judgment and to look upon elders as being perhaps too rigid or too authoritarian over the kids. And that in the best cases, each generation ends up tempering some of the worst tendencies of the other. And so each generation really has a responsibility to assume a critical posture toward the other generation and towards themselves. And I think what has happened, among other things, today is that too many of the older generation, coming out of the youth culture of the 60s, looked upon agedness with some suspicion. Remember the motto of the 1960s, don't trust anyone over 30.
That's right.
Well, all those people are over 30 now.
Way over.
And so they still retain a lot of the youth-oriented attitudes, and the last thing they want to be considered is cranky, curmudgeonly, obsolete, dinosaur-like, and that in my world, at least, we see way too much indulgence of youth, way too much hesitation to criticize adolescents for their precisely adolescence.
Well, you mentioned the phrase elders, and that really isn't one that's used very frequently in our society. It's usually the older generation or seniors, and we're either out to pasture or about to be, and I can't even remember the Bob Dylan line, but something if you can't get out of the way, essentially. And that's been, maybe even since the teenage rebellion in the 1950s, certainly into the 1960s, that the older generation, the generation with power at a given time, are always an impediment to real important progressive change, and hence that attitude. So, and I guess I would say, I like the title of your book. I'm all for provocation, but I guess I began with saying that a young person, if you said, "Look, you're the dumbest generation," it's not going to get a very good hearing. I guess.
Sure. And the thing to do is to clarify, why are they the dumbest generation?
Sure.
Not because they're less intelligent. They're just as smart as generations have ever been. They're just as ambitious. In fact, more of them are going to college than ever before. Also, they have other advantages. They have better attitudes toward their parents. They have good behavioral measures, such as lower rates of violent crime. So we have some good things going on with them. Also, they have more spending money than ever before. Generation Y is a marketer's dream because they do have so much discretionary spending. They're a nightmare because it's so hard to predict where their tastes are going to go. But added to that, we have them growing up in a society in which there are more opportunities to gain knowledge and skills than ever before. Sometimes when we pass through the grocery checkout line and look at the magazines, we think our culture couldn't be getting too much dumber. But in fact, we have more museums today than ever before, more historic sites. We have more colleges than ever before. We have more libraries. And, of course, we have the Internet, which is instant access to great artworks, old books, government documents, current affairs, foreign affairs, geography, maps, paintings. Everything else is there with a double click. So the access has never been higher. The money has never been higher. So the advantages are all there. And when we talk about the knowledge economy, young kids are told all the time, learn more, become more adept, more verbal, better vocabulary, become skilled in the ways of current affairs, the economy, finance, trade, and so on. So everything is pushing them toward becoming more skilled and learned. All the ingredients are in place for an informed, engaged, younger citizenry. And yet, the illumination hasn't happened in measures of young people's knowledge of history and civics. It's abysmal. Every time they give the national exams in history to high school seniors, more than half of them score below basic, which is essentially an F.
Well, Mark Bauerlein, let me ask you this. In your book, The Dumbest Generation, you cite a number of very, very worrying statistics about knowledge. More than half of 17-year-olds can't place the Civil War as occurring in the second half of the 19th century. But I wonder how these, and maybe you could name a few others of the specific historical dates or personages that shocked you, so to speak, and compare it, though, to, say, 30 years ago and 50 years ago and 100 years ago. I mean, are we actually dumber or the young people this time? Do they know less about history and sociology and what have you than previous generations?
Most definitely the average high school graduate today knows less about those traditional areas of history and civics than the average high school graduate did in 1955. There's one study that compares this. We see literacy rates have actually dropped in the last 15 years for younger adults, for college-educated adults. They know less. For people going to college, more and more of them are ending up in remedial writing and reading classes. If you go up to Michigan State University and ask the admissions office how many of the students entering there have to go into remedial reading and writing courses and math courses, they will roll their eyes and shake their heads and say this is a huge burden, a big cost, because we are teaching things now that should have been taught even down in eighth and ninth grade at this point. If you ask employers today what they see are the knowledge and skill levels of recent graduates, people just coming into the workplace, they will complain endlessly about bad grammar, bad writing skills, bad communication skills, and bad reading skills. And so I think that there are certain areas of adeptness with technology that we find kids have far more than their seniors have.
Mm-hmm. You're a professor of English at Emory University in Atlanta. Anecdotally, what do you see when I don't know what level you teach at,
right,
but what are your experiences?
Well, if you polled college teachers, you'd have to go a pretty long time before you found one who said that entering freshmen write better and read more widely than they did 20 years ago. What happens is that the reading and writing habits that they form in the most popular activities that they do on the internet, which is social networking, give them a certain quick facility. They can skim things very quickly. They can write little notes very quickly. But if you ask them to develop a coherent argument, to draft a complete paragraph, if you look at their vocabulary levels, you'd be disappointed every time. And this is because they are communicating with one another in these zones. Social networking is what the internet is really about for most of them. The internet doesn't open them up to the world of ideas, to the universe of the past, to history, to foreign affairs, other governments, and so on. It opens them up to contact with one another, That's what adolescents care about. A 16-year-old doesn't care about what a 45-year-old thinks. A 16-year-old cares about what the other 16-year-olds in homeroom think. They don't care about what happened 150 years ago in the Civil War. They care about what happened last week at the party between Bobby and Betty.
Well, but the same thing was true with you and I when we were teenagers, at least with me. I shouldn't speak for you, but what you say in your book, The Dumbest Generation, is that there's so much more access to the personal now because of technology.
Exactly. Peter, I'm 49 years old, and my social day ended when I left school, played basketball with some buddies, and then went home. And when I crossed the front door and went inside, that was it. 6 o'clock, I had dinner. I had to have some contact with parents. There was the landline, as it's now called, but I didn't feel like, oh, now I've got to call my friends and see what's going on. I didn't have a cell phone, no laptops, no email, no instant messaging. Now, kids go home and they go up to their rooms, which are multimedia centers. And what does the media do? Well, the laptop has the email, they got the handheld, the BlackBerry, the cell phone, so that social contact, peer-to-peer connection, is 24/7, and they can sit in their bedrooms at midnight with that laptop open and carrying out a chat with a buddy down the street and a buddy 1,000 miles away.
So we're talking about a social setting, a social matrix in which the norm is texting. I mean, for full disclosure, I don't even have an answering machine on my phone. I don't have a cell phone. I don't know how to text. And I think I'm pretty well connected. But when we're talking about people in their teens and now into their 20s and even into their 30s, texting is what hooks people together. It is the social milieu. To not be involved in it, unfortunately, is to be the weirdo outsider.
Exactly. If you ask an 18-year-old to go 6 hours without checking the cell phone, without looking at the personal profile page, without getting or sending any messages, anxiety sets in. Go to a college, go up to the University of Michigan, and go out on one of the quads. And watch the kids passing by between classes and count the number of them that got the cell phone to their ears, or they're looking at the little cell phone screen and typing in a message. They've got 10 minutes between classes, and they've got to check in to see what's going on. They have to find out where everyone is meeting that night. They have to hear the latest news on whatever the gossip is for that week. And if they're not checking in, if they don't have a Facebook page, yeah, it's the equivalent of not getting picked to play kickball in sixth grade, and you have to sit on the bench while everyone has fun.
The book is The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future, or Don't Trust Anyone Under 30. The author is my guest on the Peter Werby Show, Mark Bauerlein, and you can go to dumbestgeneration.com. I'll be giving that again at the end of our interview. Also, it'll be on my site, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E .com. At your Emory University classes, I know professor friends of mine are always debating whether to allow laptops, and they say, we're taking notes, and then they always suspect that they're really checking their email. Do you allow, laptops and or cell phone, which then people are texting, into your classes?
You know, this is the first semester in which I have considered refusing laptops into the classroom, because the first time I sat there at the top row in my survey of American literature class, a lot of the kids have their laptops open, and they are always in the back. And when you look at them, and you're talking about some serious work of literature, the end of a story when Edna commits suicide in the novel The Awakening, and you see kids up in the front row, and they're smiling. They're not taking notes. Not in this novel. They just got a message. They just learned something. They saw a joke pass by their screen. So we may have to cancel all laptops in class.
Well, if that continues.
Your title, The Dumbest Generation, I never quite put it in those terms, but we're supposed to be living in the so-called information age, and like you, it doesn't appear to me that at least that people aren't any smarter. I mean, you're making the assertion that, in fact, that it's a dumbing down, and to me, it is the noise, in a sense, the inability. I mean, I'm sort of ADD to begin with, so unfortunately, I'm in an industry that doesn't penalize that. But the idea to be able to focus and to sit and read and to reflect, to read a page in your book and go, wait a minute, let me read that again, or wait a minute, how does that fit in with what he said on page 52 and I'm on page 181 and go back to it? You can't do that online. So there is an entire new, I can't remember what the word for it is. There's a different cognitive manner in which people are assembling information and remembering it.
This is what they talk about with multitasking. And the simple fact is that in an average 15-year-old's life, the idea of sitting down for 90 minutes with a book in a room with no interruptions, that simply doesn't figure. That just doesn't happen. There's always a cell phone call coming through. There's an email. There's an instant message you need to check. And also, there's the TV show that you want to hear, or the iPod that has to be programmed. So those spaces of reflection and disconnection, those simply aren't there. And a lot of them, in terms of their cognitive habits, begin to feel a little bit uncomfortable. It's irritating if you don't have that stimulation coming in, if you're not in touch. They simply don't like it.
What is the negative here, though? You and I can tell, share a sense that to be able to perceive the world in complex terms and in logical terms makes a lot of sense. But some people might say, who cares? I don't care when the Civil War of the United States was fought. I want to check with my buddy. Or to me, we have a virtual community. You guys have your nose stuck in a book. I'm texting friends across the country, maybe even across the world. You guys are so 20th century.
Exactly. Well, the thing we can do is put this in some civic terms and say that when you are a citizen in a democracy, you bear a burden of knowledge that you do not bear if you live in an aristocracy or a monarchy or a theocracy or a totalitarian state. One of the first things that totalitarians do when they take over a society is to erase the memory of the past. What does the memory of the past give people in a democracy? Well, one thing, it gives them heroes. It gives them villains. It gives them origins of civic ideals. We have our founding documents, and we keep those in mind. We have to replenish these in our own lives every time we vote, every time we think about Supreme Court challenges to certain laws, when we look at national policies. And if we don't have a memory of the past for those, then we only respond to them in present circumstances, which means we're only consulting our own needs, our own interests. And this is not good for the civic health of the Republic. If we don't remember the example of Abraham Lincoln and of Teddy Roosevelt, what standard do we apply to our political leaders of the present? By how much they take care of us? By certain policies or where they stand on the political spectrum? Well, all those things do count, but there are also certain standards, enduring standards. And if you don't remember the figures from the past, you don't have those standards at hand. And so a democracy filled with people who don't revere their political and cultural inheritance, well, they end up getting the government they deserve. They end up getting the leaders they deserve.
You know, I just looked in the bibliography of your book, is that what you were saying reminded me of Neil Postman's book, Amusing Ourselves to Death. And there's a subtitle to that that's something or other in the age of... But in any event, sticks out the most in my mind, talking about politics. He talks about the Lincoln-Douglas debate and how these ordinary people came. When I say ordinary, I mean we usually think of people from 100 and whatever 50 years ago as being limited in their ability to, in their intellectual abilities. Yet these were people who sat and stood and heard 2 one-hour presentations, essentially written essays by each of the candidates, Lincoln and Douglas, then were told to go home for a dinner and come back for the rebuttals, which were each another half hour or 45 minutes apiece.
Mm-hmm.
No one could do that today.
This was a form of civic engagement that everyone accepted as part of the nature of American democracy. When Alexis de Tocqueville toured America, he was a dispossessed French aristocrat who came to America in the 1820s and then wrote about it in a great book called Democracy in America. He was amazed at the way in which in these distant frontier towns, people would gather when a newspaper would arrive. And someone would read the entire page of the newspaper giving information about what is going on in Congress and what's going on in foreign affairs, and they would debate it. So this was actually a community event, and everyone looked forward to this, and that this is one of the things that he found is amazing about American democracy. When Lincoln gave the Gettysburg Address, you know, the famous thing was he spoke for 2 minutes and he followed someone who spoke for a couple of hours. Well, the fact is that the man who gave the address for 2 hours, that was the norm. And people came and they wanted to hear those speeches go on. Lincoln's speech was an anomaly.
Well, we are getting towards the end of things, and probably, as I remember when I interviewed, I'm trying to think of the man who, Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television, he said, turn it off. I don't think too many people have, and this book was from the same period as Neil Postman's, not very many people have listened to his admonition. What do you expect out of all this? In other words, this is all expanding. It's not contracting.
I think on the macro level, Peter, that there is nothing to be done, that we have to look on the micro level. And so parents and teachers affect their children and their students. So what parents need to do is after dinner, each day you simply say, we're all going to sit in a room and we're all going to read our own thing. You can read anything you want. Doesn't have to be schoolwork. You can read a cheap, romance novel, whatever. But for 1 hour, you're going to disconnect. No networking, no cell phone, no screens. And after that hour's over, you can go do whatever you want. So it's a question of balance, but parents have to be vigilant about carving out a space against all the incursions of social life.
I'm smiling here because I remember after dinner being essentially forced to listen to classical music and just hating. I couldn't wait to get away from it. It probably took me 20 or 30 years to get back into enjoying symphonic music. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just worried because I actually share the identical concerns that you have because through the shallow level of the way people are assembling knowledge and information these days, it's really much, much more open. The person's much, much more open to being manipulated by these different messages. That's one of the main concerns in politics, in consumer choices.
Peter, I can't hear any Wagner without a shudder of remembrance of all those Saturday mornings when I was awakened by my father blasting those thundering strains of the Valkyries throughout the household. So yes. But look, if you say to kids, look, pick your reading matter. Harry Potter,
sure.
or whatever you want. I think the important thing is not to talk about the value of certain books, but to, again, carve a space of seclusion for an hour. I mean, this is how you build study habits. This is how they're going to be able to go into the library when they're 19 years old in college and work on that paper without being interrupted every 5 minutes, because that's what you have to do if you're going to write a good paper. So it's creating patterns in the day, creating a rhythm in their lives
that disconnects them for a time from their friends. And I think what they'll find is they may look forward to it. A lot of these kids are overwhelmed by all this social contact, and it becomes a rat race for them. And I actually sympathize. We know that middle school can be a gauntlet of judgments, and these kids have fragile egos, and a rejection can be crushing to them. To create a private zone for them where it's just them and a book for
more
a while.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Excuse me. I didn't mean to cut you off like that, but we are unfortunately out of time. I could talk about this probably for another 2 hours. A better way, though, get the book, The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future. Another subtitle, or Don't Trust Anyone Under 30. Mark Bauerlein has been my guest. It's published by Tarcher Penguin. You can go to dumbestgeneration.com, also to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Mark Bauerlein, thanks for being on the program.
Enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Did I win?
Lutz.
I won?
Thursday.
Dude, are you serious?
All day this Thursday, exclusively from your Walk Right In Free Station. 101.
Who are you?
WRIF.
Are you receiving monthly checks from a lawsuit you won? Are you having trouble paying your bills every month because the settlement money you're getting just isn't enough? Well, there is a way you can get the cash you need now in one lump sum payment. For free information to see how much cash you can get, call Peachtree Settlement Funding now at 1-800-931-7654. Find out how you can turn your future structured settlement payments into the cash you need now to get free of your credit card debt, to meet your rising mortgage payments, to pay your medical bills and other expenses. If you're receiving payments from a lawsuit, call Peachtree Settlement Funding. For your free information, call now 1-800-931-7654. You have bills piling up that need to be paid now. So why wait any longer? Get the future money you have coming to you now when you need it most. For your free information, call Peachtree Settlement Funding now at 1-800-931-7654. That's 1-800-931-7654. 1-800-931-7654.
Prices assume 5% down payment at 7.5% APR over 30 years.
Wow, look at this place. 4 bedrooms, 2 baths.
Yeah, I know.
Jeez, you're not even 30. We have the same salary, Maggie. How can you afford all this?
My mortgage payment is less than $300 a month.
What? That's less than I pay for rent. How did you...
All I did was call BNI for a list of homes that are being sold for back taxes or foreclosure.
Home foreclosures are on the rise. That means there are great deals out there, especially for first-time home buyers. Like this listing, a 4-bedroom, 2-bath going for under $20,000. That's just $199 a month. Listings go fast, so call BNI for a list of these homes today. Call 1-800-497-5930.
I could actually afford to own my own home.
Yeah, and it's easy. Just call BNI for the list.
Properties that have been foreclosed or repossessed are a real bargain and sometimes sell for little money down. For a list of homes in your area, call 1-800-497-5930. 1-800-497-5930. That's 1-800-497-5930.
Back to the Rock.
This is a fantastic moment for me.
101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction. In the fields of bodies burning, as the war machine keeps turning, death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah. World stops turning, ashes where the body's burning. No more war pigs have the power, and as God has struck the hour, day of judgment, God is calling. On the knees, the war pigs crawling. Mercies for the sin. Satan laughing spreads his wings. Oh, Lord, yeah.
WRAF HD1 Detroit. The wait is over.
Kind of gives you a feeling of power.
The most successful morning show in Detroit radio history is back. Drew and Mike return to the Motor City this Monday, exclusively on 101 WRAF.
No.